Committee of the Whole, please come to order.
Mr. Chairman.
Majority. Floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For ladies and gentlemen, for your general file, House Bill 143 had to be moved down to the bottom of the list today, and I'm sorry if there was a confusion on that. So the next bill for your consideration is House Bill 118, but there may be some privileges of the floor that are necessary first. Thank you.
Representative Campbell, privilege of the floor.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor, please. Thank you. Members of 63rd, I want you to welcome and say hello to a past member of this body, Scott Ratliff from the Riverton area.
Welcome to the floor. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege?
Granted.
Thank you. I'm going to pile on. Scott's a friend of mine. He's a friend of all of ours, but he represents he did represent, essentially, even though it was an at-large district, essentially he was a really strong representative for the district in which I now reside and represent. So I've roped with him and team roped with him. He's a good guy. I just wanted to add to that, Scott. Thank you. Good to see you.
The first bill that we will be in consideration of will be House Bill 118. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 118 from Representative Berger, an act relating to the Wyoming Community College Commission, modifying the standard budget request process for formula allocation of state appropriations, requiring further process refinement and imposing reporting requirements and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, of Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 118, Education Community College Commission budget request, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Freeman, Hunt, Yagi, Northrop, Patton, Paxton, Piperinen, Summers, and Throne, signed by Representative Patton, Chairman, and further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, who respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Patton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee moves that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 118 on the Community College Commission budget request do pass. With that, I would yield the floor to one of the principal sponsors for the Majority Floor Leader.
Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Chairman Edwards. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you the Community College Commission budget request bill, which is really modifying the standard budget process that they've been using historically, so House Bill 118. And ladies and gentlemen, most of you have served with me long enough to know that I served on the Appropriations Committee and have been involved in the budgeting process. And over the years, of course, the community colleges would come before us. And the community colleges have a very complex budgeting model. And we, as members of Appropriations, of course, would get very frustrated as to how they came to their student enrollment. But I guess actually what got me more frustrated over the years was just that we funded them retroactively on student enrollment. And the way they got to their student enrollment would always become a complex conversation. And yesterday was a reminder of being in appropriations. Keep in mind that this bill did go through the Education Committee previously in the week earlier, and then it, of course, was re-referred to appropriations because it's a change in our funding model that we're in anticipation of for the budget, next biennium budget, which would be for 2017-2018. And as you know, we're working now the supplemental budget for this biennium. And during the next interim, our agencies will start working on a new budget. So in anticipation of that, I had proposed a couple of years ago that our college commissioners, presidents, and trustees work together to see if they could propose a way that we could come to a new way to model a budgeting process that we as legislators would understand. Here's my simple reason: that we will not all be here in a couple of years or 4 years or even 10 years. This to me has been an institutional process that has really changed since my period in the legislature, 2003. We've made a lot of demands and changes on community colleges and supported them. And as you can tell by this bill, we have a lot of support for community colleges. In fact, I don't think I've ever met anyone who didn't support community colleges or any of our higher institutions in the state of Wyoming. It's something that we take great pride in. So with that, they came to many of us this last fall with a proposal of how to go about addressing student enrollment. All right, the problem still comes down to how do you define student enrollment? And as we went through the bill, my bill, really, our bill, if you look at pages 2 and 3 of the bill, was to bring, and 4, it was to bring to the Appropriations Committee a funding model that the three entities that really govern the community college would design and bring to appropriations. And later you will find with a committee of the whole amendment that in our discussion in appropriations yesterday that possibly there should be another alternative to how we come to that model, funding model. And so we'll have that discussion. I think there are many of you here on the floor that would like to look at that. But truly, the purpose of this bill is to come to a funding formula that is stable, not about making the funding formula richer, but about being stable. We historically fund the model at about 65%. As all of you know, they get their funding from mill levies, from vehicle license income, from tuition, auxiliary funds, various ways of doing their funding, just as we do with our other institution across the hill. We have various ways that we collect the funds to provide education to our students. That isn't the question, but from our general fund, we do provide about 65%. That does not include what we discuss about capital construction and how they go about that. That is a separate discussion. We do have a statute that provides for giving them permission to raise monies and build buildings, capital construction, and then for major maintenance on their properties. So that's something that we as a legislative body approve. We also, over the last 10 to 15 years, have given them direction and money to build buildings to provide education and training for certain industries so that we can create economic development and have encourage businesses to come into our communities. Because I think for many of us, we promote business in our communities, and that's an important thing. When we were in an economic downturn in our communities, we looked to our community colleges for retooling our workforce. It's critical to our communities. So we're here today really just to have a discussion about how do we move forward in creating a sustainable model that we as legislators understand and we can work with our community colleges and making sure that we're confident that we're providing the right funding stream and that we also know that when we're in an upswing, it may be better with their enrollment, and at the same time, they're going to have a painful time if we are in a downturn in our economy or a downturn in their enrollment. And the benefit, I think, when you look at this bill, is that there's an incentive for community colleges to look at what are their student outcomes, because we want the best for our Wyoming students. We want them to graduate from a community college or a higher institution with the best education possible and capable to apply their knowledge to whatever job or place that they go. And so with that, I would open it to questions and discussions, and look forward to the debate, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move budget amendment, House Budget Amendment number 1 to House Bill 118, and ask for your favorable approval of it. And everyone, if you look in your box, I've got there's a draft, and what this is not, you have both the amendment, which looks like this, and that's the amendment, but the one that has the kind of the background print underneath, that just takes the amendment and sticks it into the bill so you know exactly what it looks like, so you don't have to read what's taken out and what's taken in. It's just a lot easier to follow and understand what we're doing. And let me just kind of give you a quick rendition of what this does. After the appropriations meeting yesterday, some of the members got together and we said, look, what we need to do, what really is happening here is establishing an allocation and a payment model. And so then the question is, and this is the ultimate question that this amendment talks about, should the Community College Commission develop that model? Or should the appropriations and the legislature develop the model? And our position is, whatever model it is, it ought to be a sustainable, fundable model that is put together by the appropriations and then brought to you in our next budget session on whether or not you agree that this should be the funding mechanism for community colleges. And so the only difference between these two, the amendment and what you have, is on the current Bill 118, basically the model is created by the Community College Commission and then recalibrated every 4 or 5 years based upon, once again, the Community College Commission's preferences. And our point is, well, we'd love to know what the Community College preferences are, but this is the obligation and the duty of the legislature to establish the funding mechanism, to determine where the money comes from and how much we spend. And so what the amendment does is it says to the bill, absolutely, we need to make a consistent, steady funding mechanism for community colleges. But we, as the Appropriations Committee and as the body as a whole, needs to have the discussion on where that money is going to come from. If we're taking monies, is it going to come from other revenues? Is it going to come from an additional mill levy? Is it going to come out of other cities, towns, and counties? Is it coming out of this pocket or this pocket? That's the discussion we have to have, as opposed to just a recalibration where it becomes a standard model and that it's the same every year and it automatically bumps up without any oversight based upon how the model's crafted. So what the amendment does in the big frame is it's okay, it's time to develop a mechanism for funding community colleges. I think most of us agree with that. And so then the question is, where does that obligation lie? Where should it be? And we, as Appropriations Committee, said, well, that really is our fundamental obligation. We'll put it together. We'll go evaluate the revenues and bring it back as a bill so that then it'll be a regular budget, just like any other agency. It'll come up in a biennium, and you'll have supplemental budgets. You'll notice in the draft bill that you have in 118, they get rid of that. Page 2, line 23, and page 3, 1 through 3, they accept community colleges from the budgetary process. And we're going, well, we don't know that that's the right thing to do. We don't want to take it out of the budgetary process where we don't review it. And if we have a problem of funding next biennium, we need to be able to do something about it one way or the other. So that's what the budget deal. We hope it's more or less a friendly amendment. And we just think it's the proper protocol to follow. And I tend to agree with the majority floor leader, but this has been a can that's been kicked down the road for quite a while. When I first ran for the office, one of my primary goals was consistent funding for community colleges. So I'm on and for the concept. I just think this is the best way to go about it, and I'd be happy to debate it further or have any other one folks up from appropriations address the issue as well.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my main disagreements with the amendment is it just has the Appropriations Interim Committee looking at it. But as the sponsor talked about, he's talking about a sustainable revenue source. And I would submit to you, if you're looking for a sustainable revenue source, you have to have the Revenue Committee involved in this. And he did talk about mill levies. Well, you only have seven counties in the state that pay into that mill levy. But all 23 counties have kids that are attending all seven community colleges. You know, that has to be part of this discussion. It's a statewide system. And we have kicked this can down the road. Ever since I've been here, we've kicked it down the road. So I thought House Bill 118 did address a sustainable revenue source. So at this point, I'm against the amendment.
Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the amendment for the bill, I think that the bill is in very good shape, and it addresses the major concern that we've had the last few sessions about what's that number going to be for the community college system. They need to be able to budget. They need to be able to plan. They need to be able to say, here's what we're looking at moving forward into the future. I think that some of the items that have been brought up by the good representative from this county, they're worthy of debate. They're worthy of debate in terms of particularly a statewide funding mechanism, whether that be a statewide levy or not. So I think that it's important. Those are important questions, but they can be addressed separately and apart. I think that this bill is a solid bill. It's ready to move forward. There's been a lot of thought, a lot of process. We've been talking about this sort of thing for 10 years with two separate studies, one Blue Ribbon Commission. I think that as a result of all that work, the bill itself is in pretty good shape. If we want to talk about some of these corollary issues, we sure can, and I think it's necessary. But as to moving forward for these tremendous assets to our community, I think that 118 is ready to go. And let's talk about some of these other issues brought up by the good representative separate and apart from that. So I would urge you to vote against the amendment for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comments are more in the form of a question, and that is, you know, we've talked about cities, towns, and counties and having them a sustainable, budgetable amount, and yet they fluctuate worse than we do. And so if we're going to review this every 2 years, are we going to stabilize them, or are we going to make it more unpredictable? It seems like to be able to go with the original bill that it kind of makes it a little more predictable, sustainable funding for the colleges. But there again, I don't know. I would have to ask that question. Does it or not?
Representative Yeagy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As this came to the committee, the big thing was we would like a budget that we can count on. We would like to not, you know, worry about every other year or every year how much money are we going to get. And I think 118, as it's the original one, set that up, that they would have a stable amount based on enrollment. There's an enrollment adjustment that was going to be put in there. But my big question was, this would be great if the state had a sustainable budget that we could count on. So this is setting up a system that we're moving the enrollment from, you know, it was clear back in 04, 05, I believe, and we moved it up to be a little more up to date. That needed to be done. There's some things in here that need to be done, but I'm thinking with the amended bill, the appropriations will look at our income and what we have to spend. So I'm really wondering if the amended bill is something we need to look at. Again, my big concern is here we're setting up, and if you look on the old bill, there's nothing this year, but in the next year there's $7,500,000, and the next year $7,500,000, and so we're not spending anything this year. They'll live with what they have, but then the enrollment adjustment will be there, and this amount that is there. So I stick up for the community colleges. I think my usual thing is they get, and this is not real accurate, but 75% of the kids and 25% of the money. And there's something a little bit wrong with that picture. So what they were coming in with was a good idea. And what our good majority floor leader said was, let's move it up, let's have the enrollment based on this number, which is a better number, but then we want to guarantee this amount of money based on enrollment, but then the state can't. We just don't have a guaranteed amount of money that we can do that with. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard spot. So we'll hear some more discussion. Thank you.
Representative Nicholas. Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a couple of things probably deserve reiteration that that's already been said, but number one, there is not an appropriation that is binding in this proposition. What is provided is a process that can be used as a calibration for future funding. So that starts on page 3 and line 11, beginning with the biennium commencing July 1, 2016, and each biennium thereafter the standard budget. So what it's addressing is the propriety of having a system and structure as to how these community colleges may begin to plan their funding, staffing programs. On the back page is the fiscal note, and the fiscal note has on it $7,549,000 for 217. That's really more of an anticipated expenditure increase from the general fund than what was there previously. Obviously, you're going to meet at least twice before that happens. So there's plenty of time actually for to do what the substitute bill pretends that it wants to do. But one-time enrollment growth on the middle of that paragraph requests the biennium would cease and recalibration of the base period would then could be resulted. So the four bullet points that are on the lower part, how these estimates are based and have the following assumptions, and then they itemize it. If we can and see the distribution to be allocated of the funds on the basis of enrollment, we would be making a significant step forward to having the administration of the seven community colleges be able to look whether their enrollment goes up or if the enrollment goes down. It's provided for it, and then they can plan and plan accordingly. So on and for the bill and opposed to the amendment.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm for the bill, and I would ask you to resist the amendment. Before I entered this floor, I was a trustee for 6 years, and that was an interesting experience when you're talking about government. Let me give you kind of a quick history. There are seven community colleges that are in the state of Wyoming. They were created by seven counties who taxed themselves and built the schools that you have. They continue to contribute four mills out of their mill levy. And then the bulk of the rest of the money that's coming to the community colleges is coming from this body. Because what is happening is those seven counties are helping the other counties that are not taxing themselves to pay for expenses. Each one of those community colleges, with the help of this body, they are doing outreach. And that is a cost to them, and sometimes there's some BOCES that can help, and sometimes there's some BOCES that can't. We have, in my political lifetime, we have had several attempts to come up with a funding formula that's fair. And we've had two task force to look at the situation. We've had proposals for bills to tax the entire state to fund this instead of coming from the budgets in this place. As a trustee, we were told by the person downstairs 6 years ago that he couldn't understand the formula, and basically what happened was is he told the community colleges to fix it. Then what happened is the community colleges got together and they found a nice formula, and that was superseded by one from the Community College Commission. And then what happened was is it took a tremendous effort by all involved to come up with something that could be understood and was considered fair. The belief that over a summer interim that they can come up with a funding formula that's fair and that will satisfy all the local politics, because each one of these communities are very much proud of their community colleges. They serve as a very important educational institution, an economic generator, and I guess the bottom line is if we accept this amendment, we open a big can of worms that I don't think that we can control over a summer interim. I think that there needs to be a look at community colleges. I think that it's long past due. But I don't think this is the mechanism to do it, and I would ask you to resist the amendment and for the bill.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in favor of the amendment. And I don't see this as a, you know, are you pro or anti community college? I think, as the good majority floor leader said, we all support our community colleges and recognize their valuable mission. Despite the chair of appropriations keeps trying to steal our state's biggest community college and saying it's in his district. It actually is in my district. But so I recognize the value of the colleges and just how important they are to our state and our economic development. That said, the real issue I see with this bill and the concern that we really had is budgetary control. And we had, and really, to their credit, community colleges were took the full brunt of the last round of cuts we went through. They went through and they took their 6%. And part of this is, remember, the structure we have now is really pretty straightforward. You've got this 2004-2005 enrollment level. And that's the standard funding that they receive in their standard budget. And anything they want over that for a growth in enrollment, they have to bring in an exception budget. And that's really the heartburn of the community colleges, is they are tired of coming in every supplemental budget and coming to us and saying, here's our enrollment. And what they've received over the period of time that we did this funding is about 70% of that enrollment growth. So we've never, I don't think we've ever funded the full amount. And so their concern is this, this uncertainty. I mean, they have a base level of funding. That 2004-2005, that's their standard budget. What's the issue is this this other amount of funding over and above that. What the bill does as written is say, we're not going to examine that anymore. When you come in, your standard budget, those enrollment figures are built into the standard budget. It's before us. You take it or leave it, you move forward. So, I mean, my real concern is, especially heading into the next biennium and the revenues that we're the instability of revenues we have coming in front of us, is you take away that extra tool to look at and evaluate what the colleges are asking for. And I understand their request for stability, their need for stability, and I think that's why the amendment balances this concern out well enough. But if you take the bill as is, you're really taking away your flexibility next year when we come in. If we're looking at cuts, then do we increase the cuts for health? Do we increase the cuts for the DDD program? Do we increase cuts for other folks because this is off the table? Or do we look at everybody, and do we examine everybody, and do we have it sort of transparent? And that's really the issue. Are we going to have this formula and this funding be transparent so that we as a body can evaluate it, or is it going to come to us as a lump sum on a sort of take-it-or-leave-it basis? And that's really where I see the issue. I mean, there's obviously funding community colleges is a huge challenge, and coming to an agreement across the diversity of colleges and communities is a challenge. But I think this amendment gets that balance and makes us look at that issue without tying our hands on future budgets.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, too, stand in support of the amendment. Members of the House, the concern that I have that really isn't addressed in the bill is we forget what the purpose of the community colleges is. And it is not the same, in my mind at least, as what the University of Wyoming is. And so when we come back and we discuss what the purpose of the college is, then we say, you know, to me, I say, well, in the bill, it talks about enrollment increases. Well, where are the enrollment increases coming from? Why do they decrease? But are the enrollment increases, are in-state kids attending, or are they out-of-state kids attending? And so when we increase the amount of general funds that we support the enrollment increases, is that because of the out-of-state kids that are coming, or is it? There's just a lot of unanswered questions there in my mind. I really would like to just have this time for the committee to look at all of these things and determine. I know in my community I've got a little gal that's in my district that had me cornered against the wall of Little America the other night with her little finger in my face saying that this is really important for them, and I believe it is. I think that community colleges are greatly important, but I think as we go forth with the type of funding that they will need, I think we need to be sure that we're approaching it realistically, and I would really encourage you to adopt this amendment.
Representative Northrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we were in committee and we were listening to this, we had a CPA come to us, and he did say, you know, it's really confusing to track the funding. He's not sure of if they're chasing dollars or the dollars are chasing them, and so they spend a lot of time playing with the budget versus the one-time funding that varies greatly, and then there's poor to no planning. And so that what we're looking for with this bill is it just puts some stability into the funding. Let's talk about the people who would go to community colleges. We realize that oil is dropping down in price, and that there's going to be a group of people that are coming back home, maybe your sons and daughters that have been in a state to the north of us, up by Canada. And as they come home, they're going to be looking for a skill. They're going to come back and say, you know, it was really nice to go work in the oil field for a while, but I need a skill now. I need to be a nurse. I need to be a dental technician or a welder or a mechanic. And some of these other things that the community colleges do that are so important to our whole state. And so I just ask for you to support this, because it's the non-traditional students that are coming back. The non-traditional students are a big component of the need for community colleges and keeping going, and I just ask you to support this measure. Thank you.
Minority Floor Leader Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure how I feel about the amendment, and I want to be clear that it doesn't defeat the purpose of the bill. Because the purpose of the bill is to provide stability for the community colleges. And the point that I don't think has been made yet is that they're taking a risk. If we have a huge economic downturn in the next few years, you know, if people flock back from the oil play in the northern part of the country because they've lost their jobs, the community colleges are assuming the risk because they're stuck with the amount of money that's determined by this formula. And I don't think anybody's mentioned that they're taking the risk of a dramatic enrollment increase, and they can't come back to us and ask for money. That's part of the deal. So I want to make sure that the amendment does not defeat the goal of the bill, which is to provide stability.
Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly in favor of the bill, but I have a question on the amendment. Line page, I guess I'm looking at the bill, the worked-in bill, and it's lines 10, 11, and 12. And I'm just curious if that is exactly how we deal with our current four-year institution. If we have that same approach with our four-year institution that we are saying we want to implement here. Because when I go to the bill itself, and this was brought up by the bringer of the amendment, on page 2 of the bill, page 2, line 23, it talked about this paragraph shall not apply to, etc. Well, read the sentence just prior to that. It doesn't apply to the institution over the hill either, at least in two categories. So, folks, sometimes the geese and the ganders should be treated equally, and that's what I would like us to make sure that we're doing. So certainly in support of the bill, I have concerns with the amendment. Thank you.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. I'll kind of work down some of the issues that came up. But first of all, I mean, I think we all realize and want a better stability of funding for community colleges. And so that's the fundamental goal of everybody, including the bringers of this amendment. And so it really is, and I think everyone's hearing that message loud and clear, and that's what we want to do. In terms of what committees are involved, obviously if there is a recommendation that we need to bring a mill levy, then that'll go through revenue. That'll be a whole separate budget bill come through and be addressed as a funding mechanism. That's just one of the criteria, one of the things that both our committee and the education committee and eventually revenue will all hear if, in fact, that's where what's the directive that comes out of this work during the interim. A couple of different things that are really unique, though, about this bill, and we're kind of missing the fundamental issue, and that is if you go on the current bill, you go down to line 16, 17, and 18, what we're doing is we're up page 3. We're adopting the community colleges funding allocation model. So basically, we're advocating that responsibility. We're saying, you know, we're just going to let you do the allocation refunding model, and there's no review of it. You know, all we can do is deny the budgetary fest, but we can't even go in and say, hey, your allocation model is incorrect, or we think you've got too much here, too much there. And that's what our job is as a legislative body is that should be our model. It should not be the community college's model. And we have never done this for another agency, for any agency, saying, hey, we'll adopt whatever your allocation model is, and that's the way it's going to be, and there's no review of it, and don't analyze it. And I don't know how many really know what the allocation model is, but it's quite complex, and when you get down in the details of it, that's where that we decide what that base funding is going to be from year to year. And then we can go in and we as a legislature can say, you've made some mistakes on your allocation model. We think it should be this because that's our determination. And then we fund it appropriately. But we're just handing over the goose and the gander on this. And then to address the comment between UW and the community colleges, it's really comparing apples and oranges. You know, that's our only four-year institution. It's in our Constitution. It's it has its own separate funding mechanisms. It's block grant in a way. And so, in essence, kind of what you're doing here is just turning this into a block grant through the current through the bill as it's drafted now without the amendment. And if that's what you want, that you can have it. I mean, but I suggest that that is not the responsible thing to do, and that the allocation process has to be a product of us and not of the community colleges. They will bring it to us. They'll bring it to the Department of Education or to the Education Committee, and we'll say, yeah, this is right, this is wrong, and then this is how much is we're going to fund it. And if you're paying too much for, like, the concurrent classes, the kids that are in high school that they're being paid for, even though the teacher's in the high school and the class is in the high school so they don't step a foot on the community colleges, are they assessing that at the right value? We need to know that. Those are decisions that we should make and not the community colleges, because that's our responsibility. And so that's our point, is that we need to take our responsibility, we need to care it, we need to be transparent about it, and that's what we're doing. And so that really is almost the most difficult part about the current bill as drafted, is we're giving up our responsibility in that reallocation process to the colleges. Right now, by the way, we fund 46% of community colleges from our general fund, and we fund 45% to UW. So percentage-wise, we're paying more of their overall budgets now than we do UW, just as an interesting fact. You know, I went to Casper College in 1975, and I taught at CWC, and all those folks, the community colleges are just, they've changed incredibly. I mean, Casper College is so different now from when I went there. It's just, it's extraordinary, and it's wonderful. But once again, those are decisions, you know, other than the mill levies and their funds, just like Schedule 2 for UW, I think we need to be in control of the purse strings. And so that's the amendment.
Majority Floor Leader Berger.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate all the discussion and the importance of community colleges. What's important here is that the model needs to be addressed and how we come to the legislature to make good decisions and how we fund community colleges. And retroactively funding student enrollment, to me, doesn't work. So we need to get over that barrier. And I believe that that frustration occurs in the Appropriations Committee. The opportunity we have today is that our college commissioners, trustees, and presidents are working together. It's really a historic event for us to have them working together, looking at the future, what our community colleges really can do for our youth and our citizens today, and to work with us, the legislative body. So it's a true opportunity for us to collectively come to a 21st century model, in my view, of how to fund community colleges. And if this amendment that's proposed, it may not be quite right yet today. Certainly we've already addressed issues with House Bill 118 that may not be right, but it's the closest thing that we've come to in 12 years in addressing what we currently have in statute and from what we've been working from 2003 to 2004. When you've heard the stories of the different commissions that we've had trying to work through this, you brought up how do all 23 counties support the 7 community colleges today. Quite honestly, that's a separate discussion that we do need to have that could affect this model. But if we don't get a stable model in place, it's difficult to even have those other discussions. And I think that we have the commitment from, obviously, revenue, leadership, appropriations, and education to work with a committed group of people from community colleges to move this forward. And we have an opportunity here to do this in the interim as a high priority so that we can put this in the standard budget. Ladies and gentlemen, this budgeting process is already in statute, and we already review this every 2 years. But what I think we do wrong is we do it retroactively. How is it possible that you or I could do this with our business, where we look back on how many people we served in business and then pay for it, or say, we'll pay 70%. That's not how you do business. You look at how much business am I going to do, how many people am I going to serve, you make the money, and you move forward, and you hope that you break even or you make a profit. If we expect our community colleges to serve our citizens well, We need to help them make certain that they can keep high caliber educators, make certain that they can keep their seats full, make certain that they have the right programs for the right businesses in their communities that need those services to move us forward and to make sure that we have a strong community college system for the 21st century. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could make a couple of points. It's been stated that this bill presents to you a formula that they're expecting you to vote on in the next three readings here. I would ask you individually how many of you really know what the funding model is and what it does. If you don't, I don't really know how you can vote for this bill. Number two, there's been some statements made that there's the goose and the gander. I think we all agree that we support community college. I don't know anybody that doesn't. But part of our Constitution on page 38, section 15, established the university confirmed, where the Constitution has identified the University of Wyoming in the Constitution. So they're different entities. They're funded differently. I totally support this Committee of the Whole amendment because it kind of sets out guidelines as we move forward. How we include, who we include in the decision-making process is up to this body. But personally, without this amendment, I couldn't support the bill, and I would hope you wouldn't either. Thank you.
Representative Freeman.
Just briefly, one of the comments is that if we accept this amendment that we're giving the community colleges a block grant, we do give a block grant to the university, the institution across the hill. We do give block grants to your individual school districts. Why not the community colleges? The other thing is I work within a community college, as you know, and without the stability of knowing what's going to happen each year, we have to make employment decisions. In my job, I could probably justify at least three new positions. And if my institution knew that there was steady funding, they would probably take a chance to make sure that they could do that to where they can keep going. Without stable funding, you are hamstringing the community colleges. And now I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself. The community colleges are the most flexible of the three educational institutions that we have. My institution and the other institutions that surround the state repeatedly respond to community needs. When my community needed trained people for the oil field or to replace people that are retiring in the major industries, my community college could get those programs up and going in just a little bit more than a year. We have a system that works. Let's fund it to where that they know that they can make good decisions for several years.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, just before I start, my daughter went to a community college, and frankly, probably the best thing that she ever did. Got a fantastic education, literally the 1 year she was there, but it helped her set a goal in life and helped her get to it. And really, I do support them. But I'm on and for the amendment, too. And I'll tell you a reason and ask you just to bear with me for just a minute. And I'll keep quiet for a minute, but I want you to stop and think of, to you, what constitutes enrollment in a community college. Okay, I think all of us have an idea. And just some questions. Is that the 12-hour full-time student? Is it the 6-hour part-time student? Is it the adult that takes a class in anthropology in the evening because they want to go dig up things out in the desert? Is it a dual and concurrent enrollment student in high school? Is it a high school student going over to the community college taking a course during the day? These are questions that we really need to come up with some hard answers to define some of these, and some of them aren't well defined. So I would say on and for the amendment, let the committee work through this process, establish these baselines, and that even in just what enrollment is, and go forward from there, rather than turning over control of the budget to the commission. And I can give you an example of a company that did this. They had a contractor who did a lot of work for them continually. And they decided that, you know, we don't want to pay a different price for what's kind of the same thing all the time. We'd like one price. Makes bookkeeping easier. But instead of watching what the contractor was doing, they told the contractor, take 10 jobs that you've done, average them out, and tell us what the average is, and we're willing to pay the average price for that work, which the contractor did. And all of a sudden, the costs went way up. And the company couldn't understand why. Well, the reason was the contractor was given the choice. They took the 10 highest price jobs they did. Now, I'm not saying that the community colleges would do that, but if you aren't watching what you're doing and the instructions you're giving, you come up with some results you might not necessarily like. So the amendment allows us some time and space before we set on a process that might not work for all concerned, including the community colleges. So on and for the amendment.
Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With full disclosure, I spent 6 years on a community college board of trustees and was also the president for a couple of those years. And I'm very much respectful of the great job that's done by the community college system in Wyoming and its growth. That said, I'm in favor of the amendment and against the bill without it. Well, I'd probably go for the bill without it, but the amendment does what I think we're down here to do for the state of Wyoming, and that is we have to adjust what we spend our money on or commit our money on based on the income the state goes. And we can't pick and choose who could have a COLA or whatever those kinds of things and do it very successfully. I think we've got to look at what our income is and balance it with what we provide to all of the groups that are funded by the state. So I'd urge your support of the amendment and also for the bill.
Representative Moniz. Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the debate. I think the philosophical question here is, do we trust the trustees? And I've also heard that if this process goes forward, that they'll have control. And we control the purse strings here. If it was to get out of control, then we reverse the process. We legislate. We appropriate. It's what we do. So I think moving forward, the bill we have in front of us looks like the best choice, and it's been well thought out. Now, we still have second and third reading to move forward, but if you look at the amount of money we're talking about here, I think since I've been here, the largest amount of money we've ever appropriated for enrollment growth is about $15 million. So put that in respect. How long does $15 million operate schools in the state of Wyoming? One day, maybe. Not really talking about a lot of money by the standards of education in the state of Wyoming. So we'll still be in control. But that's the philosophical question you have to ask yourself.
Aaron Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be short.
Madden.
Patton and Madden sound alike, I guess. Who do you want?
Patton was up here at first, so I'll let him go ahead.
Sorry for my neighbor to the south. A couple of things need to be rebutted, if not prolonged. There was a committee in the legislature that did look at full-time employment, full-time equivalencies, and the number of credit hours that they used were used as a part of that calculation. Joint and concurrent is there. So don't suppose that all of this is just all of a sudden happening. This bill came about by virtue of a long-term look at what is going on. Since 2005, there's been significant changes. There's been significant changes in what is being offered. There have been significant changes within each one of the colleges and the communities that they serve. We expect them to be able to respond to retraining a workforce for economic development. 1965, that wasn't there. This body in 1965 said, this is going on, you're having all this development at each one of the high schools that desires to have a post-secondary education opportunity is free to do so. And so they did. 1965, they said, whoa, the legislature said, we can't go keep going this way, that this has got to stop. We're going to put a limit on it. There's only going to be seven colleges. That were the seven colleges that were then in existence, plus the University of Wyoming. Since then, the communities themselves have been the developers. They have done the essential development, and the state has found out what an asset it is. It is economic development. This isn't something new. This isn't something that's just happened. Give them a chance to plan, and plan accordingly so intelligently that they can continue to serve economic development, the development of a workforce that is sustainable for the state of Wyoming. On and against the amendment for the bill.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All I was going to mention, you know, I didn't know much about this till this discussion started, but, you know, I'm on the Management Audit Committee, and we did an audit of the school across the hill here, and years ago, I think it was in the late 90s, the legislature, you know, I guess for whatever reason, decided they didn't want to get into the weeds of how they spent money over there, and so that's when we got into the block grant. And the block grant, it was assumed that there would be a self-allocation process that would be gone through over there. And in the discovery of the audit, we found that whatever the pot of money was that was in the block grant in a biennium budget, the people over there were in turn issuing little block grants to all the colleges. And the reason I bring this up is that, you know, that's when the legislature lost track of the funding allocation formula. It might be why we have, deals over there where if we want a new college or something, we fund it separately. And, you know, because all these little pots of money are pretty well institutionalized. And I guess to kind of conclude, when I look at this original bill, it kind of looks like what we're doing is creating the opportunity for the commission to, perhaps at some point have a block grant and that they do the allocation among the colleges, the community colleges, just like we did in 1990 for the colleges within the university. And I think, you know, the Appropriations Committee has a reason for this on that basis, is that if you don't, you lose track of it, and 1990 gets to the year 2000, and 2000 gets to 2010, and before you know it, you got a challenge. So I think I support this amendment. I think that this gives more allocation oversight. That may not always be good in some cases, but it seems like it would work here.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question I have to ask is, are we kicking the can down the road again? Because what it sounds like is we have a funding model that we've been using for our community colleges, and it's set at 2003-2004 levels. And the formula has been all worked out. We may not understand the formula, but the formula exists. And basically what the bill says is, okay, we're going to use different sets of enrollment data. We're going to use 2013, 2014 data. We're going to keep the same formula. And then we have a problem that I'm hearing is that, well, we don't have enough control. That formula isn't working. And so let's kick the can down the road. Let's go ahead and amend this, and we're going to go ahead and have an interim study on a different formula, a funding model. Do you see how that's kicking the can down the road? So the question is the funding model right now ideal? And it may not be. But then again, how much do we want to micromanage this? I mean, if we have a block grant, do we trust our trustees to make those decisions, or do we want to micromanage every little decision that our community colleges make? And I don't think that's our job. I don't think that's my job. So on the on support of the bill, but not the amendment. Thanks.
Representative Nicholson.
I just got up because I'm sure I can convince one person to vote differently if I speak one more time. it's a good debate. What's interesting is we've talked about some principles, but we haven't talked anything about money. And it's how do we sit here and talk about what's right and what's wrong to do when we don't have a full grasp of how much we're going to spend, what we're going to spend it on, and what those priorities are? And those should come out of here, and the legislature should do it. Under the current amendment, this is all going to happen between now and next year. Actually, under the bill without the amendment, it doesn't kick in until 17-18. So we're actually going to expedite it and have something on the ground and running that everyone will have to work with. But so good debate. On the other hand, we only talked principles. We didn't talk about the hard part in the budgeting, which is what our responsibility is. And we can't do that until we have a chance to bring it in front of you. Now we're just saying, let's go with the model that's out there. And if you don't know enough about it, then just trust somebody. So thanks for your time.
Is there any other discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, all in favor vote aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division of the House, all those that are in favor, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 passes. We're on the back on the bill. Majority Floor Leader Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I burned up more than 20 minutes here, ladies and gentlemen. Now you know why I brought you to work early. Thank you all for your concentration and your interest in the community colleges bill. It's really important, and there may be further work that we do on it this week, but just do keep in mind that, you know, we do have a funding structure in place with our statutes today. We have been working through this process for many years. It does need work. I think we have folks today that are ready and willing to work into the future to make a solid budget for 2017. We currently have community colleges funded through 2016. This bill before us does not have increased funding in it. Thank you for your consideration and ask for your favorable support today.
Majority floor leader. Majority floor leader. Did you have discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Patton's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number 118 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 118 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 107. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 107, presented by Representative Wilson, an act relating to professions and occupations, adopting the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, requiring reporting, making a confirming amendment, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, of Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom we referred House Bill 107, Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baldwin, Dayton, Edmonds, Harvey, Kasparic, Schwartz, and Wilson. Two no votes, Representatives Barlow and Larson, signed by Representative Harvey, Chairman. Further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, who respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Harvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 107 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, which is, if you'll look at your amendment, it is a very short renumbering correction. And with that, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question being called on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. House Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 is passed. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would turn the explanation over to the fine sponsor of the bill, Representative Wilson.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brothers and sisters, I feel it is incumbent upon me to bring the average back down to 20 minutes from 70, I think, is where we've been at. So although this is kind of a fat bill, I'm going to really do the 30-foot level, and if you just have to know something, you can come up and ask. But this is the second of some bills that I'm bringing that are aimed at addressing the health care provider shortage in this state, and you will be happy to know that it has no appropriation, no tax incentives, and no license plates. So... I heard the question being called, but perhaps I should give a few sentences. This actually would enable us to participate in an interstate medical licensure compact. It is being put together now. We've had people from our state involved at a national level in putting the compact together, which is a great opportunity for us to actually have an early seat at the table in the activities. Those of you who have been around a while know that Wyoming participates in quite a number of interstate compacts, and they are a good tool for states to work together. What this does is maintains the regulatory and licensing authority that our Board of Medicine has over physicians, but provides a sort of a fast-track processes for physicians out of state who want to practice in the state while still meeting the requirements that we expect of our physicians. Couple of advantages is that it does identify that the practice of medicine occurs where the patient is located, so the standards met are the ones that we expect of our patients here in Wyoming. And there is also an additional benefit, which is that unlike the present, medical boards would be able to share information about licensees who participated in the compact in case of disciplinary actions, which they can't do right now. And I would just add one last thing. No physician has to apply for a license through the compact. This is purely optional for people who want to do telemedicine or specialty practices, and they want this. A person who wants to practice and just follow the traditional path does exactly what they do now and nothing different. So that's the 30-foot level, and I will stand for questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Harvey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 107 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. House Bill 107 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 209. If the reading clerk would please read the bill.
House Bill 209 from Representative Miller, an act relating to public lands, providing legislative findings, requiring transfer of public lands, specifying distribution of the proceeds from sale of public lands, creating a joint select committee on the transfer of public lands, providing duties of the committee, providing definitions, providing an appropriation, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number one, Judiciary, was referred to House Bill 209, Transfer of Federal Lands, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Halverson, Croker, Miller, Pinnell, and Winters. Those who voted no, Representatives Escobel, Crone, and Pelkey. Signed by Representative Miller, Chairman, further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, who respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, and Stubson. Those who voted no, Representatives Connolly and Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 209 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And as I explain the bill, I'll also explain the amendment at the same time, and then I'll call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment, and then we'll continue the discussion on the bill. This is an issue that's been long festering in Wyoming. You have a fresh handout in your box. The front page, of course, has the map that shows the great divide between the states east of Wyoming and the states west of Wyoming. Why did the states east pretty much not end up with the majority public lands in their states? It's just that the settlement course of the nation started from the east to west. We were tardy at the end, and we didn't get all our land settled before the federal management kept increasing their grasp on this land. Just so you know, this year, besides Wyoming, there's active legislation concerning this issue in Arizona, Colorado, Montana, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Washington, New Hampshire, Texas. The states in the east that are considering legislation is just supporting legislation, usually resolutions, telling the federal government to release control of these lands to the states in the west, just like they did in the states back east. And one state's already done that. South Carolina has passed a resolution supporting this effort in the west. You know, it's all this.
it off? Okay. If all the states were equal at their creation, why do we have this big difference here in the West? It's clear the difference didn't stem from the states when they were created. Oklahoma was in 1907. That was nearly 20 years after Wyoming. California in 1850, 40 years before Wyoming. North Dakota in 89, and of course Wyoming in 90. So why the difference? For nearly 200 years, Congress recognized its duty to dispose of public lands. It wasn't until 1976 that Congress passed the Federal Land Policy Management Act, in FLPMA, unilaterally declaring that it was their new policy to retain these lands in federal ownership. And, you know, just a brief review, FLPMA was in 76. Prior to 76, the lands were managed under the Taylor Grazing Act. That was 1934. And in the Taylor Grazing Act, there was this comment, in quotes, pending final disposal of the public lands. And frankly, I don't think Wyoming or any of the western states had any problems with the federal, with the Taylor Grazing Act. Things operated just fine. Prior to that, the Federal Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, frankly, that act here in Wyoming made things very complicated. Ever since I've been in the legislature, we've been debating bills talking about the split title stuff. Well, the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 is why we have split title. The government in the homestead, when ranchers or farmers were homesteading, prior to 1920, they got everything. The timber, the minerals, the surface. Starting in 1920, they said, well, I think these minerals may be valuable someday. These guys in Washington, you know those guys. So they started doing the split estate stuff, and that's been really complicated. A lot of legislation has passed the last 12 years in this body concerning split estates and how we can manage it better. And prior to that, all the enabling acts of the various states allowed, the land to basically go to the private sector. So on page 2 of the handout, up at the top, forever disclaim all right and title. Article 21, Section 26 of our Constitution, that the people inhabiting said proposed states do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof, and that until the title thereto shall have been extinguished by the United States, the same shall be and remain subject to the disposition of the United States, and no taxes shall be imposed by the states on lands or property therein belonging to or which may hereafter be purchased by the United States or reserved for its use. Well, that looks pretty clear that we really don't have any right or title to these lands. And that's generally where people stop when they're starting to investigate this issue. Read on down at the bottom. One of the common myths that are thrown out in regards to the transfer of public lands is this is like nothing that's been done before in our history. That's simply not true. You can see the map of the U.S. there, the original colonies and a few states to the west of them, and then the colonies immediately west, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. They all had this same issue back in the 19th century, and it took multiple decades to get the federal government to release those lands. But ultimately, through the efforts of some senators in the Midwest, they got it done. So it's not a new issue. It's been done before. Go to page 3. Again, forever disclaim all right and title. And that the people inhabiting the said territory do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the waste or unappropriated lands lying within the said territory, and that the same shall be and remain at the sole and entire disposition of the United States. Slightly different than what it says in the U.S. Each state has their own little version, but it kind of sounds the same. But that particular state is Alabama. They have less than 3% of their lands tied up with the federal government. And then there's another one. You can look at the next one, roughly the same language, Louisiana, 4.6% public lands. Go on down to the state immediately east of us. Again, similar language, 1% public lands. You know, it just goes on. You can look at South Dakota and North Dakota, two states that came in about the same time as the U.S. And then finally, there was a whole slew of states that basically adopted the Northwest Ordinance as state as their statehood and enabling act. And these are all states along the Mississippi River, east of the Mississippi River. And finally, the last page in the handout, back in 1932, the Senate had 8 days of hearings in Washington, D.C. If anyone is interested in really understanding this subject, I've got those documents. I've got a hard copy, and I've got an electronic copy, if anyone wants that, to get into this. But I think it's important to understand that this isn't a new issue. They were actually working on it and making progress in the early 1930s. As you can see, this was March and April 1932. There was an election in the fall of 32 that changed the direction of the country dramatically, and they pretty much ceased this effort and came up with the Taylor Grazing Act instead, pending final disposal of the public lands. I should also note that back, I believe it was in the teens, the federal government did offer our public lands back to Wyoming and some of the other western states. But it wasn't, all it was the surface. They didn't want to include the minerals. And our politicians at that time declined that offer. That's my understanding. I need to research that one a little bit more. Now to the bill, House Bill 209. An act relating to public lands, providing legislative findings, requiring transfer of public lands, specifying distribution of proceeds from the sale of public lands, creating a joint select committee on the transfer of public lands, providing duties of the committee, providing definitions, and providing an appropriation and an effective date. So there's three new statutes created, 3612201 through 3612203. Page two are the reason why I bring this bill. Page three, four, and five are definitions provided that apply to the bill. This defines some of the national monuments, defines some of the national parks, defines some of the wilderness areas, and those are clearly left out of this action. We're talking about the non-special BLM lands and Forest Service lands that aren't part of a wilderness area or a park. On to page 6. The top of page 6 is basically 3612203 is requesting to the federal government that they transfer the public lands by a certain date. Item B, if the state subsequently transfers title to any public lands received under subsection A above, the state shall, and this is important, Romanet 2, transfer 95% of the net proceeds the state receives from the transfer of title to the United States. So if we receive the public lands and the state at some point decides to sell a portion of the public lands, 95% of those funds go back to the federal government. This isn't something new. This is something in all, I believe, the enabling acts of all the states in the West. When the lands were sold, 5% of the money was supposed to go into the school systems in those states, and 95% of the money originally went back to pay the war debt. And originally it was the Revolutionary War, and then the War of 1812. So they just kept moving it on. I guess wars never end. Okay, Section 2, this is where we create the Joint Select Committee. This is where the First Amendment comes in on lines 10 through 16. Basically, this amendment changes the makeup of the committee from two and two from the majority and minority caucuses of the House and Senate to three and one of the majority and minority caucuses of the House. I believe the majority of you will like that part. Okay, the chair will be chosen from its membership. On to page 8, another change. The Public Lands Commission, this is what they're going to study, administering the transfer of title of the public lands, addressing the management of public lands and management of multiple uses of public lands. That's under on line 8 through 12. There's another change in the Standing Committee amendment. After land, strike 10, 11, and 12, and the new language inserted from the Standing Committee amendment is recognizing all existing rights. And so this is really important. Whatever rights that are recognized on the public lands right now, whether they be BLM or whether they be Forest Service, if someone has a grazing lease, if someone has a lease on a hunting camp on Forest Service land, if there's mineral leases, oil leases, grazing leases, all those rights have to be recognized to the full extent. We don't want to take anyone's rights away on any of this. They will be managed by the state of Wyoming the same way they're managed now, except by the state, which will hopefully be more proactive to changes. Okay, on to page 9. These are some of the determinations they make, a whole listing of them. You can add some if you want, but they're pretty all-encompassing. Page 10, the Joint Select Committee on the Transfer of Public Lands shall also study and determine whether to prepare proposed legislation relating to the transfer, receiving title to the public lands from the United States, establish a prioritized list of management actions for the state and political subdivisions of the state. And then it goes on to talk about to preserve and promote state's interest in public health, preventing catastrophic wildfires, which are a huge problem on some of our public lands. You know, frankly, with state management, we'd probably harvest some of that beetle-killed timber. Preserving and enhancing range conditions, preserving and enhancing energy and production of minerals, increasing plant diversity, reducing invasive weeds, establishing procedures and requests for subjecting public lands to property taxation. You know, if someone's doing something economically productive on those lands, if we lease it out and they build a building on it, if they produce minerals, of course, that's where our taxes come from in Wyoming here. And that's another whole subject. We tax minerals in Wyoming. That's what we're down here doing, is trying to decide where that money goes. You know, if we want to make Wyoming a big park, you know, just recognize what we would need to do. And if we don't collect mineral revenue, where are you going to get the money? Is it going to be a state income tax? You know, I don't know. You know, if you don't have access to your minerals, you're not going to have mineral revenues. And there's an attack on those assets and those resources right now, not in Wyoming really, but from the east, who thinks these lands are their lands, not our lands. The next amendment from the Standing Committee amendment is on line 1 of page 13. It says, now public lands as recommended by the Director of Office of State Lands and Investments and the Attorney General. That after the balance of line 1 on line 13 is struck, the balance of line 2 is struck, and governor is inserted in there. Deliver a final report by January of 2017. So we have a couple of years for this study to occur. There's appropriated $25,000 for the various meetings. I think there's 5 meetings over a 2-year period that this group will meet. And again, you know, this isn't going to happen next year or the year after that or the year after that. What we're trying to do is get the process going in the proper way. One of the big efforts is to make some progress, to make this not just a Wyoming alone effort, but the Western states as a group. That's why I'm bringing this bill, is to make sure we stay up to speed with what some of the other Western states are doing and push back on what the federal government's doing to us right now. So with that, I'd be happy to stand for questions. Let me go over the Standing Committee amendment first again. I mentioned where they were inserted. It changes the 2-2 from the majority and minority caucuses to 3-1. The second amendment inserts and recognizing all existing rights. I think that's important because we could name individual rights, and some bills elsewhere do that. But this one, basically, if you have a right now on the public lands, whether you're an ag operator, whether you're an oil and gas operator, that right is going to be the same right you have right now, except managed by the state of Wyoming instead of managed by Washington, D.C. And the final amendment is deleting the director of the Office of State Lands and Investments and inserting the governor. So I'll call for the question on the amendment.
Minority Floor Leader Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a few questions and concerns. I believe the good sponsor referenced the president elected in 1932 who saved us from the Depression and established most of the social programs that we rely on today and got us through, World War II. So I just have a slightly different take on that if I heard that correctly. But back to the bill. The questions I have on the bill, looking at the first page, the legislative findings.
Which bill are you on? Which bill are you on?
You're on the amendment. Sorry. Go ahead.
Question being called on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, vote aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. Back to the bill. Representative Byrd.
Back to you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill. This is one of these things that has popularity of things like that little rock that came in a box, nails in a box, and other things that have a shelf life inside social media of about 6-7 months. It's really popular. It makes you feel good, kind of like that college bender you used to go on and rant and rave about being against the establishment. But when you wake up from this, this is what happens. If we're successful in this, we will acquire property and title and responsibility for a large amount of this state that right now we don't have to pay anything for. We're getting a free ride out of this. So it's been pointed out that if we decide and when we find out that we can't afford to hold on to these federal lands that we get transferred, 95% of that money would go back to the federal government. My question is, when we sell this, those become privately deeded lands. Those privately deeded owners are not responsible to hold up to any of the agreements. So the next thing after that comes the no trespassing signs. So now your public access that was public access, as we know it right now, goes away. Unless you can guarantee me that the end game here is public access ad infinitum, and the state has the money to pay for all of the oversight, regulation, and things we need to do to maintain this, this is a bad idea. It's going to cost us a lot of money. We're going to have to expand several apartments that you people in this floor have expressly said don't do their jobs very well with what they have and the money, and you want to cut that back. How are we going to go down this road and make this work? That is a very interesting thing I'd like to hear you guys tell me.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment on one of the comments there. I don't think it was a question, but go to page 6. Please read lines 18 through 20. Transfer 95% of the net proceeds the state receives from the transfer of title to the United States. So anytime any of these lands are sold, 95% of the funds get transferred back to the federal government. I don't think Wyoming has an incentive to sell any of these lands. If we did, we're going to have a darn good reason for it, because 95% of the money is going back to the federal government. As far as not being able to afford it, that's a common thing that you hear. The federal government keeps 52% of our mineral royalties right now and is blocking access to our mineral development. Again, We can make a position here in this body. We can just simply ban mining and oil and gas production and impose a state income tax if that's what the body wants. That's the way we can fund all these programs we want here. So I'm not proposing that. Minerals can actually pay the bills in perpetuity, but there's just one caveat for that. You have to have access to the minerals.
Minority Floor Leader Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am on the bill. So I have a few questions. Looking at page 2 of the legislative findings, I'm always uncomfortable with these things in any bill. Subsection A, I don't know what the empirical evidence is for all of those points. I certainly haven't seen it, so I'm a little uncomfortable finding it when I haven't actually seen the data to support that. Subsection B is contrary to my understanding of the law, and so I wonder, do we have an attorney general's opinion or something or a case to support what we're supposedly finding in subsection B? With regard to the mineral estate, am I to understand that we are only taking the land under this approach and not the minerals? You know, with all due respect, minerals is how ranchers in my part of the state where I grew up managed to hold on to their ranches for generations. So to not have the mineral rights and just take the expensive land seems actually backwards to me. I'd rather take the minerals and let them keep the land from a purely fiscal point of view. So those are my main questions. I'm a little concerned as to why a wilderness was not included in the list. I mean, you do include recreation, but we have some world-class wilderness areas in the western part of the state. Maybe I misunderstood that. And I'm not referring just to the national parks, but the whole western Wyoming ecosystem, from the Winds to the Jim Bridger to the those are world-class wilderness areas, and I don't see any reference here to acknowledging those. So those are just a few of my questions.
Representative Clam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to this issue, this has historical constitutional and legal precedence. In fact, if you look on your handout that you have there and you see that great divide, you see that the eastern half of the country is all white and the western side is shaded. That shaded side is federal land that is claimed by the government. To put it in perspective, it says there are less than 50% of state-controlled land on the western half there and more than 95% of state-controlled land there on the right side. Now, one counter-argument to something I heard is, you know, we can't possibly afford to manage our own lands. Well, look at all of those other states there, where all the white is. They're managing their own lands, and most of them are doing just fine. You say, well, how can they afford it? Well, let's put this into perspective. Those in revenue, think about this in particular, our mineral royalties. We get 48% of the minerals. Now, I come from coal country. 48% of what we produce as far as the mineral royalty rights, that's what comes into our state. Now double that. And do you think that we can manage our lands off of that doubled amount? Because if we did not have to, and let me back up. Some of you are looking at me, you know, glazed over, and you're not knowing what I'm understanding or what I'm saying here. These federal lands, 48% of Wyoming, 17% of the minerals, these lands are lands that we cannot tax for our local economies. We can't tax to produce revenues for education. The minerals, it's the same thing, the mineral royalties. So they go to the federal government, and what they give us is they give us something called PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, which is a joke. You say, well, Scott, wait a second. This does not have any kind of precedence at all. This has, again, historical, legal, and constitutional precedence. In fact, this goes back to the founding of our country, just as the good chairman was talking about a moment ago. In fact, a little bit of history on this, just to put some of this in context. During the Revolutionary War, we were going broke. We were losing the war. didn't have the money. Well, the king had told six of the states, I believe, he says, here's the boundaries of your state, and you have claim to the western lands. The other state, I believe it was seven, they didn't have any kind of claim to the western lands. And so basically at the Constitutional Convention, they came together and they came up with this idea that these western lands were going to be held in trust by the Constitutional Convention. And what was going to happen is when a new state was formed, that 95, the federal government would go ahead and dispose of those lands. That's where we get this language where the states extinguish all right and title to the land, because what they were going to do is saying, okay, we're going to extinguish all right and title to the land, we're going to give it to the federal government, the federal government's going to dispose of it, and we're going to have the lands that we can manage, which has happened in all of those states where you see that white. And 95% was to pay off the public debt, 5% was to go into a permanent fund for education for those particular states. And that's happened all the way up until 1828. In fact, I think on your second page, that's where it is, you see there's a lighter shaded areas, that's Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Iowa, those, I guess I can't say those states. You can see the shaded areas, those were the western states at that time, and they were facing the exact same thing that we are facing today. In fact, I believe it was more than 50% of their public lands were controlled by the federal government, just like it is here in Wyoming. And they say, hey, wait a second, we know our rights. And they stood for their rights, and they put pressure on the federal government. You see, what's happened is the federal government has reneged on its promise. The promise that we gave is we would give all right and title to our lands. Federal government, you dispose of those lands, and that hasn't happened. In fact, the good minority leader was talking about court precedents. In 2009, there was a court case, a Supreme Court case that involved the little state that's in the middle of the ocean. And in that case, they said, in particular, when it comes to these enabling acts, that the enabling acts are promises between two sovereigns. And those promises can't be changed by an act of Congress. And that's what happened in 1976 when the Federal Lands Management Policy Act came into place. And they said, hey, wait a second, we're going to permanently retain these western lands in our control. And that's the fight right now, because Congress has reneged on its promise. It's saying we're going to hold these lands under federal management control for perpetuity, which is what the 2009 case, Supreme Court case, said, no, Congress, you don't have the power to do that. And so here we are today. Well, what will this mean for Wyoming? Well, think about this. If we can get our lands, and I would argue, yes, we want our minerals as well, we can manage our own lands. Look at the states that are to the right of us on this map. If they can do it, we can do it, and we have the means to do it. So with that, I'll stop ranting. But this is a good bill. And what this is a statement. This is a statement to our Congress that says, keep your promise. Because we can pass this bill, and ultimately it's not going to mean a hill of beans, because Congress has to act. But what this does do is it puts pressure on Congress, just like the state to the west of us. They were the ones that really started this thing with that 2009 Supreme Court case. And so what we're doing is we're trying to put pressure on the federal government, in particular on Congress, to say, keep your promise. And folks, this can happen. It's happened before. And if we keep at it, we can get our lands and we can get our minerals, and we'll be better off because we can manage those things a heck of a lot better than the federal government. And I know some of you might take issue with that, but states have a history of managing things better than the federal government. So with that, I'll stop my rant. Thanks.
Representative Coper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to answer a couple of questions that were raised by the minority floor leader. Wilderness areas are specifically left out of the land that would be transferred. If you look at page 5, line 7, it specifically mentioned wilderness areas designated under the National Wilderness Preservation System. So those are included. And the bill absolutely includes mineral rights, because that is the key to our state, is getting those mineral rights. I think the confusion over that, it was mentioned that at one point Wyoming was offered the land without the mineral rights, and the legislature at the time rejected that idea because they said we need the mineral rights with those. So this bill would include the mineral rights. On and for the bill, it's something we definitely need to make sure that the federal government is going to keep its promise to us.
Representative Summers. Mr. Chairman, thank you. This issue is, I guess, on and intrigued with this idea. 80% of my county is in federal ownership. My livelihood is 100% related to federal lands, 100%. My landlord has not always been benevolent. Having said that, there are a lot of people in my county that utilize public lands, including myself, for a lot of reasons. So I get a lot of response when something like this comes up. You know, there's people that intrigue, people that like it, people that hate it, but I get a lot of comments on that. What I'm wondering from the bringer of the bill, there's been another idea out there that's going forward, and I'm sure the bringer knows about this, but there's this idea, and I'll just use it because we've went through a similar bill in this committee, a kind of an agreement state status. There's actually a pilot project that's been proposed to allow the state, perhaps in a pilot situation, to manage the lands. And so I'm wondering how this bill, if it relates to that effort, would feed into that effort, if they're divergent efforts, but still intrigued with the idea, but understand that these lands are very important to my side of the state for a lot of reasons. And so I don't have a lot of faith in my landlord right now at times, but I also worry about the uncertainties of the future. And I know that people that hunt, fish, recreate, move cows, drill wells, we all want some certainty. So that isn't the case right now even, but there's just a lot of concern out there.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, excuse me, to address a couple of points, you heard about the formula. If Wyoming were to sell the public land, 95% would go to the federal government, 5% would go into our education funds. So Wyoming has no incentive to sell the land. On the other hand, the federal government has every incentive to sell its public lands. The federal government in the next year is going to spend almost $400 billion in interest on the debt. Ecuador could not make its debt payments to China. China said, no problem. We'll take half your country. China, not half, but China now owns a good chunk of Ecuador, and Ecuador is out from under a lot of debt. So the federal government is the one with the incentive to sell the lands. BLM will look us in the eye and say, we have not reduced grazing acreage one iota. We have all this acreage that's always been available for grazing, still available for grazing. Then you ask them what the AUMs have done. Well, they've dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. So effectively, our agriculture producers are scrambling for grazing land. Let's see. Abandoned mine land funding is gone. We're being shortchanged on the federal mineral royalties due us. When I go to a national organization, I thank them for their PILT payments. They ask me, what am I talking about? And I say, well, you pay money to my county because we cannot tax 74% of my county. And I explain to them what PILT is. And this is what motivated South Carolina to pass its resolution, and I garnered several sponsors from eastern states for a similar resolutions at this national body. So, on and for the bill. Thank you.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to answer the fine gentleman from the other side of the Wind Rivers from where I come, I have looked at what one proposal was, is to try to do a test area managed by Wyoming and managed by the state, managed by the state, basically. And I talked to the people that have talked about that. There was an editorial in one of the statewide newspapers about that. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, and I did talk to some other folks that were behind that. And basically, we can do that right now, because in many areas of Wyoming, we have existing state lands and we have existing federal lands that are right next to each other. And almost in every case, I think you would find that the state lands are more productive than the federal lands that are adjacent to them. But, really, I think, a study of existing lands like that, I think, might be appropriate at some point and might be a fallback position with another bill, maybe at another time. There was another question just concerned about management and how things are getting more and more difficult. And frankly, that's the same thing I've seen. I started my career basically working on the federal lands in minerals back in the middle 70s. And, at that time, the federal lands were the easiest and least expensive lands to acquire. State lands were second, and private lands were the most expensive to acquire. And now, 35 years later, is the exact opposite. I just want to go to areas where it's private lands. I can sit down and drink coffee with the rancher and make a deal. I can't sit down and drink coffee with the BLM and make a deal, or the Forest Service. It just doesn't happen. We heard testimony yesterday about the delays, delay after delay after delay on the forest lands in Wyoming on a certain project that is strategic to national defense here in this country. They can't get their permits. And what they're going to do ultimately is going to be the same effect on the environment. If you let them turn it on last year or you let them turn it on 10 years from now, the effect's going to be exactly the same. So why the delays? This is why bringing all this under Wyoming control, where the people in Wyoming, the regulators have to report back to the people of Wyoming. Why is this being delayed? Is there a reason for it? If there's a good reason for it, okay, the people of Wyoming are going to accept that. So, on and for the bill, and I don't think I answered all the questions from the gentleman, but maybe I'll remember the rest of them.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the handout, and in reviewing it, one question that came to mind, and I'd ask my colleagues to take a look at that schism in the map. On which side of that graph would you rather go hunting? On which side of that graph would you rather go fishing? On which side of that graph would you rather go hiking, mountain biking, rock climbing? A lot of those lands on the right side of the table have since lapsed into private control. We have a finite resource in land. Private property is a wonderful thing, but public lands provide an opportunity for recreation and experiencing the grand wonders of Wyoming. And I think we ought to step cautiously before we take a step in the direction of either removing that land from strict federal control and putting it in the hands of people who may not manage it as well. I respect the idea that we need to develop minerals in this state, but we need to protect our most precious resource. And our most precious resource is our wilderness and our wildlife and those amazing world-class migration routes. And I'm not confident that this bill would protect that.
Representative Winters.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm going to keep my remarks very short, because we're proceeding through our bill list this afternoon like a herd of turtles, and so we want to pick it up just a bit, but I want to answer a few questions. First of all, there was a question that was asked regarding wilderness areas, and there was a mention that they didn't see that in the bill. If you look at page number 5, I believe that you can see that in lines 4 through 7. It talks about any other lands within the exterior boundaries of Wyoming as of July 1st, 2015 that are managed by the United States as a national park designated national monument or wilderness area designated under the National Wilderness Preservation System. That's included in those areas that we're not talking about within the scope of this particular bill. And as people have talked about the great fear that all of these lands are going to be sold off. It's been highlighted several times that there's a tremendous disincentive for us to sell those lands off because most of that money would be returned into the federal government. What we're doing here is we're talking about federal public lands becoming state public lands, and that the lands would be continued to be managed for multiple use, the same way that they're managed now, only at a far better economic rate, because the state of Wyoming can handle those lands far better than the federal government can. And as far as whether you would like to hunt on the right side of the map or the left side of the map, I can guarantee you that there is plenty of hunting that goes on the right side of the map. It's not as though that has disappeared. There's lots of fishing. We do have different species of animals over here, and that's a wonderful thing. We're actually trying to make sure that those lands do remain open for multiple use. That's not even a question on the table. But also, and I felt that I just had to say this as well, as far as a certain president saving us from the Great Depression, there was a very famous economist that proved in the 1970s that he probably lengthened the Great Depression. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I only have one more observation about the map. And aside from the Lone Star State, a lot of those states are much smaller than our state. They have larger populations than our state. I mean, look at the population of Wyoming. What is it? A little over 600,000 now. Look at the square miles of it and the management of these lands. Look at it for what it is. They want to circumvent the permitting process. They want the rich to get richer. They want to be able to drill. I'm fine with that. That's our revenue. We have decent revenue streams in Wyoming, and that's attributed to minerals. But you have to make that choice. Is what's the perfect balance between what's good for our revenue streams and what's good for the quality of life that people enjoy for living in Wyoming? The things that we hold near and dear to our hearts. And I think that quality of life is important to the people of the state of Wyoming. And it probably is about a lot of outdoors activities. There's a reception tomorrow night. Ask the people in your districts that go hunting and fishing if this is a good idea. You'll have a chance to visit with them tomorrow night.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are we afraid of? This is a wonderful opportunity. This is one of those one-time-in-a-century kind of a deal. Why don't we look at it? All this bill does is allow us to look at it, try to move this forward. If we don't like it, we don't have to vote for it further down the road. So this is an opportunity. I will tell you that, like my good colleague to the west of me across the mountains, I rely on my income from federal leases for grazing and outfitting, and there's so much uncertainty built into that business model that people ask me, why on earth do you do that? Well, it's because I really like it, and it provides a valuable service to the country. So if I would much rather deal with state agencies under with these resources under state control, local control, than the external forces that are applied to the federal agencies that roll downhill and affect my children's livelihood. So this is one of those times when we broke from England, one third of the country wanted to have a revolution, one third didn't know, and the other third didn't think we should. This is an opportunity. So let's be bold, let's be courageous, let's take this step. And let's chart our own destiny. We can write the laws to protect access for the hunters indefinitely. We will have a revenue stream. I would not vote for a bill where we sell those lands. I want those lands open to the public for access to hunt, to drill, whatever. Pretty much like we are now. It's just that the title would be ours. It would not be the federal government. With the people from out of the state that have different agendas, that don't have a dog in the fight, telling us how we're going to manage our resources. So thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at a social media post dated September 25th by our junior U.S. Senator. And it says, the U.S. Forest Service recently proposed red tape that requires reporters to obtain permits to shoot photos or videos, even on an iPhone, in federally designated wilderness areas. If reporters don't get the permit, they have to pay a fine. This rule makes it clear that the Forest Service believes that wilderness area is government land, not public land. So I guess that just illustrates what the federal government does with their land and how they manage their land. On and for the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 209 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
The bill has passed. Division. All those in favor, please stand. House Bill 209 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Hunt.
Privilege, please.
Granted.
Friendly reminder, folks. Four bills, 2 hours. One of those bills took like 2 minutes. So we're averaging 40 minutes per bill. By all accounts, I mean, we have a right to speak our mind and say what we'd like to say, but just keep in mind, if we begin pontificating, then the sound, as to paraphrase a former speaker, the sound that you hear in the distance are bills that are not going to be heard, and they're dying very slowly and agonizingly. So just keep that in mind and enjoy the rest of the afternoon.
Majority floor leader.
Thank you, Chairman Edwards. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to move up on your general file for the next bill for you to hear is House Bill 143.
Thank you. House Bill, the next bill will be House Bill 143 for our consideration. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 143 from Representative Madden, an act relating to motor vehicles, amending provisions relating to vehicle registration fees as specified and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 143, Motor Vehicle Registration Fees, respectfully reports sending back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blake, Campbell, Kennedy, Eklund, Reeder, Walters, and Davis Wannitzer. Two no votes, Representative Allen and Laux, signed by Representative Dave Zwanitzer, Chairman, and further review by your Committee Number 2 Appropriations, who respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Moniz, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Patton? Madden.
Pick me.
Zwanitzer, sorry. Got it wrong three times.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 143 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. And I'd like to go ahead and take care of the Standing Committee amendments. In the committee, we changed the word from dry to unladen, and that has to refer to the weight. We're not aware of any definition in the statutes that defines the word dry weight, and so we went with unladen weight. Also, the department said if this bill passed that they would need the extra time, so we changed the effective date from July 1st of 2015 and inserted January 1st, 2016. And with that, I would stand with any questions on the amendment.
The amendment, question for the amendment being called, all those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed, been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the explanation on the bill, I will turn it over to the Representative and Chairman Madden.
Chairman Madden. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a short bill in front of you here. This is a bill that I'm sure most of you will like because it cuts fees. It cuts fees for registering recreational motorhome and trailer fees and stuff like that. And in the same time, it should predictably increase revenue by a significant margin, just like sometimes you see tax cuts, or most of the time when a tax cut is undertaken, you'll see an increase in revenue. Now, I'm not totally blind to the fact that a lot of you have gotten poison pen letters in your mailbox about this, but I also know that you're objective enough to listen to the facts as I see them. Now, you will have to have this handout. I didn't know this was going to be postponed until this time of the day, so this came out just before noon, and it's a two-pager, and it's got my initials on the bottom with House District 40, and I want to show you what it does. But first, let me show you the failure that we have in the Chapter 3, which is in Title 31, Chapter 3, Paragraph 101 in the statutes. The way the registration fee works, worked well at a certain time of our history. And here's the way it works. If you've got a vehicle, and they call this a vehicle, and it's in the same kind of a part of the statute as what an automobile would be, there's a formula that's based upon the factory price of all things. And as a matter of fact, for example, if you have a motorhome that is worth or that costs $350 or $350,000, and you bought it and you want to register it in Wyoming, here's what the formula is. You take this $350,000, you take 60% of that, and then you get another number that's about $200,000, and then you take 3% of that. And that gets you to the grand total of $6,300 for your registration fee. This is not a tax, but it's a fee. So to put a license plate on your vehicle and drive it around in Wyoming or wherever you want to drive it, it costs $6,300. And because of that failure in our law, as a consequence, we don't have many people registering motorhomes. Just like the emperor of the Roman Empire found out in 54 A.D., if you lower taxes, you end up with more revenue. Well, he had other less altruistic reasons for doing his deal with taxes, but I digress. What this does, folks, is convert
fees for a motor home or a fifth wheel or some kind of a recreation vehicle to the schedule you see on page 2. And there's it's a function of two different things. It's going to be, it's not dry weight anymore. We'll call it laden weight. And that was in the amendment, as you recall. So the weight's going to have an impact and the vehicle age will have an impact. Okay? Now, why would we want to do that? Again, the reason to do that is because it will cause our revenue to increase, in my opinion, because we're not getting any of these kind of vehicles registered of any number in Wyoming. Now, if you found the handout by now, I want to show you how people react in the marketplace when fees are so confiscatory as what we have for motorhomes particularly and also for some of the high-end fifth wheels. If you've got that open, what I'm proposing in my fees is what you see in the upper left-hand corner. This is for a $210,000 motorhome that weighs 31,000 pounds. And, you know, $210,000 is kind of an entry-level Class A motorhome, so we're not talking about a pretty fancy one. We're talking about a kind of a run-of-the-mill one. But anyway, in Wyoming, it would be $3,780. You pay the treasurer for a license plate for the year, and then the next year you pay $3,150, and it goes down a little bit. But the interesting thing is it can be 100 years old, and it's still going to be $945 a year. Well, people naturally vote with their feet when they see fees like that. And my proposal says let's change the fee to $480 for the first 4 years, and then we drop it to $336. And that's what I've got. That was the machinations going through my formula or my schedule I have on page 2 of the bill. Okay? So it looks like, oh, my gosh, we're losing a lot of fees, but where are we losing them to? I've got two boxes there. We got two adjacent states. The Rushmore states got, actually, it turned out that they just raised theirs to this price that I've already proposed earlier than that. After I looked it up, I found out it's the same. So anyway, that's the same that they have there. And then the state to our north, it doesn't matter if if you got $1 million motor home, you pay $282.50. Okay, and it gets to 4 years old, they drop it down, give you a little break at $224. All right. Now, people that buy motor homes in Wyoming are not ignorant to this fact. Okay, and we had a considerable testimony in committee yesterday that shows that state, particularly north of us, has made a very lucrative business out of attracting Wyoming motorhome owners to come up and form limited liability companies, put this asset in the limited liability company, and get it for $282.50 instead of paying what would I say, $5,000 or $6,300. It isn't a hard choice to make. And the impact is similar for other things. The fifth wheel is cheaper. There are fifth wheels, but the real benefit of this comes with motorhomes that are prohibitively expensive to register here. If you do use your favorite search engine and you look at registration fees in that state north of us, you will get a whole page of lawyers. Okay, you don't get any dealers or anything like that. You get lawyers that say, for $590, I'll set you up with a limited liability company and save you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars over the course lifetime of your vehicle. Okay, well, let's just see if I know what I'm talking about here. Of course I know.
Let's go to page 2, folks. Go to page 2 of my handout. You'll see on the top the state to our north and its population and the Rushmore State and Wyoming, their respective populations. You know, they're in the same ballpark. But let's look at the number of motorhomes that's registered in the state to our north. There's 24,962. The Rushmore State's got approximately 12,000, and Wyoming comes in third at 4,427. And what I wanted to do is normalize this so that we had how many of these motorhomes we have per 1,000 population. So in Montana, it's 25.8, and in Wyoming, it was 8.2. And South Dakota's somewhere in the middle. And I guess I would ask the rhetorical question here. Do you think that's just because Wyoming people really don't like motorhomes? Or do you think it's because a lot of those 24,962 motorhomes are Wyoming motorhomes held in limited liability companies up in that are located in Wyoming? The kind of testimony we heard during this discussion was that there's a lot of economic activity that is created because of this discrepancy at our expense. Number one, that state sells lots and lots of motorhomes, and this is not the only reason. They don't have a sales tax on motorhomes either, so they get the double whammy. They save there, and they save over the long run. They save thousands and thousands of dollars every year. It's more money you can make on the stock market if you keep it up there and in this limited liability company. Other things that we heard in committee was that when they have these expositions in states around us and they have displays of motorhomes, accompanying these displays will be scattered organization, actually law firms that are there to help you fill out your limited liability application so that you can sign on the dotted line and get it registered in that state. So let's take a look at this little construct here on the bottom. And what I've drawn is a locus of the relationship between the amount of a fee and the amount of fees collected. What I'm submitting to you in here is that the Wyoming fee is so prohibitively high that we sacrifice millions of dollars of revenue, okay? I'm saying that the X on top is where Wyoming is, and the state to the north is probably the dot on the bottom. I'm suggesting they could probably make a lot more if they would just raise it a little bit. Maybe raise or double it, and they'd still end up with a lot of business volume. But anyway, you can see somewhere in the middle here, there's a fee that makes sense economically, okay? And that's what motivated me to bring this. Now, in line with this, and I'm just about done, you'll see in the fiscal note they're projecting a decrease in revenues, and I want to explain the way they explained it in committee how they did this. What they did is just took the drop in price and assumed no quantity elasticity at all. In other words, they were assuming that the result of dropping the price would not increase the number of motorhomes and fifth wheels in Wyoming one iota. And I have done some arithmetic here. It says that, you know, where is that one where I, yeah, we got 8.2 motorhomes per 1,000. If we could double that to get to another 4,000 or approximately 4,000, we would end up with this much more revenue. 1.92 million. That's just on motorhomes alone, folks. And I would submit that we would have that revenue instead of our neighbor to the north if we would have a price that isn't so prohibitive. So that's kind of the bill, and
you know, some of these missives that have come out talk about, well, you can't do this because it's a tax, and it isn't. It's a fee in lieu of a tax, and in my opinion, I think that there's no problem with taxing or assessing a fee on a different basis, because we do it for agricultural vehicles and everything else, and that's what motivates me to suggest this lower motor vehicle fee, and I hope that you can support it. So that's all I have, and I'll answer questions if anybody has one.
Representative Northup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few years ago, we tinkered with the fees on the trailers, and I've had a lot of constituents come back and complain at me about it. And so I asked one for an example. He has a 1995 trailer. Last year, it cost him $15 to license it. This year, it cost him $40 to license it, which is a $25 increase. It weighs 5,250 pounds. It looks to me like it's going to cost him $63 to license it, which from 2 years ago was going to be a 400% increase, a little bit more. But
Chairman's monitor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I definitely rise in support of this bill. Folks, any time that you have a product and the two neighboring states average one, I think, a little under 300 and the other one at 400, and our price to get the same service is $3,780, then I think we're doing a great disservice to our constituents here in this state. So I think it does need to be changed. These were put in a long time ago when different circumstances happened. And so especially if you're up there in that northeastern corner, you have a problem. At $400 extra, my calculations say, if as you look at that fiscal note, that's just a little under $700,000, we would just need 1,500 more people to come back and put their motorhomes here in the state of Wyoming. And of course, if that happens, a lot of other benefits happen along with it. But look at those numbers, folks. For the state north of us, 24,000 people have registered, and to the state to the east of us a little bit, 12,000. And as you look at our state, we've got under 5,000 people. It's really making some honest people head to the wrong side there to avoid this. So I think no matter how you look at it, we need to look at getting this fee decreased. And with that, I would stand in support.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand the heart of the bill, and I think for a new vehicle, this makes a lot of sense. But I guess I want to ask a question again. When you base what the charge will be simply upon the weight versus some sort of standardized understanding of what the potential value of that vehicle is. If you have a vehicle that's around 20 years old, it could weigh a lot, but now it's being taxed far in excess of its value. And so that's one of the concerns I have. I'd just like to hear an idea of how we came to weight versus some sort of standardized value.
Representative Steinmetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good gal who deals with this sort of thing in my county office sent out an email asking, how does this affect Article 15, Section 11 in our Constitution, uniformity of assessment required? Thank you.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that the Constitution that you read it talks about uniformity of assessment, and assessment it refers to taxation. This is a motor vehicle fee, okay? So in my opinion, that's not what we're talking about. It's just we're talking about setting a fee and what the right fee should be. The other question from the representative from District 50 involving saying, well, we changed the schedule for registration, and how can you reconcile this? And I can explain that too. The values that I gave to you are the values for the county vehicle registration fee. In addition to that, you have a state registration fee. And that latter portion that we dealt with a year or two ago goes to the Wyoming Department of Transportation. So that should clear that up. And that, what else did I not copy down here? I got... I think that was all of them. The whole key is on the last page of my handout. I mean, it can't get any plainer than that. The reason that we don't have motor homes is because of the same thing that has been true for over 2,000 years, that if you set a fee or a tax high enough, people vote with their feet. And what they're doing now is they're voting by going north and setting up these limited liability companies. Now, the question is, you know, can you do that? And the testimony we have is you can go up and set up a limited liability company in that state or any other state you want, if you want to. But the revenue department will say, well, you're not supposed to do that if you live here. But, you know, the testimony we have is that they have places to winter these things in the state to the north of us, and they will have literally hundreds of these motor homes in a lot up there. And the testimony we heard was that the majority of the bills that go out to pay that $150 a month rent to store their motor home goes to Wyoming addresses. So, you know, that's the reality of it. You know, it's just a matter of what you want to do about it. I think there's an easy solution. It's the same solution that we have used for centuries. Some of you that can remember your economics days will remember this curve as being the Laffer curve that was discovered in, when was that, 1968, I think, and it was been famous ever since, and it's worked ever since. So that's all I have, and if there's nobody that wants to, I'll call for the question.
Question being called, are all those in favor of Representative Zwanitzer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 143 do pass? All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. House Bill 143 has passed. The Committee of the Whole. The next bill that we will hear is House Bill 192. Will the reading clerk read the bill, please?
House Bill 192 from Representative Freeman, an act relating to the Hathaway Scholarship Program, providing for the ability to petition to increase scholarship award as specified, requiring rulemaking, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, the Committee Number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 192, Education, Hathaway Scholarship Program, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Freeman, Hunt, Yeagy, Northrup, Patton, Paxson, Piperinen, Summers and Throne, signed by Representative Patton, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Patton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 192 do pass. The measure relative to the Hathaway program has a significant amendment to it, but the body of the amendment is such that it blends into the bill in a fashion that I think the explainer of the bill would be more appropriate to move. Representative from Sweetwater County.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me explain the bill and then put the amendment in, and we will I move the amendment, and we'll blend it in as we go. This is a very simple bill. It is my goal to get done in 3 minutes. What it does is right now we have a Hathaway scholarship, and one of the big things that qualifies you for the Hathaway is that you have a high ACT score and a high GPA, and depending on where you're at, you are placed in one of four different levels. Once you get there, you're there forever. And if in my family's genetics, standard tests are not good. We don't do very well at them at all. So what this bill does is that if you go to college and you maintain a 3.25 for two semesters, you can petition to where that you can raise the amount of your Hathaway scholarship to the next level. So what it does is it's an incentive for a person that's on the Hathaway to do well in school, and basically if you do, then what happens is you're rewarded with a higher paying scholarship. To maintain the Hathaway, you only need a 2.5. So what you're doing is you're adding a significant performance level to that. Now I'll add the amendment, and the amendment is very simple also. When does this take place? We may have somebody who's been on a Hathaway scholarship for 2 years and has been maintaining a 3.25. We can't go backwards, so what the amendment says is that the scholarship that you're going to be evaluated on starts with the enacting clause, which I think is July 1st. So first I asked for the question on the amendment that specifies when this bill takes place, or the effects of this bill takes place.
Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor of House Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please vote aye.
Aye.
All those no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. Have been adopted. We're back on the bill.
And I'll accept any questions.
Representative Zawana, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on the bill. Does it work the opposite way, that if a student gets in like an honor Hathaway with a 3.5 and a high ACT, and they go to their first couple of years of college and they don't perform as well as we think, does it work in reverse now?
Representative Freeman.
It's my understanding that if you don't maintain the minimums of the scholarship, then you will lose your scholarship, and then there's a process to where that you can earn it back.
Chairman Madden.
Just the question on what's this going to cost? I looked at the fiscal note, and it says it's undeterminable, and that's a flag, I think. I'd like to know. There's got to be some way of audit to go back and see how many people would have been elevated given past history.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Freeman.
It's my understanding that they don't keep records to where that could be determined.
Representative Eklund.
I've not weighed in on much lately. This looks like a good plan to me, because and the former speaker mentioned cost, but I think it's pretty expensive to send our students to college and then have them drop out in a couple of years. This is incentive for them to do well when they're there and improve the scholarship. And I think it'll save us money in the long run. I don't know what the cost would be, but it sounds like a good plan.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Patton's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that Bill Number 192 do pass. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. House Committee, or House Bill Number 192 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 193. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 193 from Representative Nicholas, an act relating to veterans, increasing allocations to veteran burial teams, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 193, Veteran Burial Teams, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Kennedy, Edmonds, Gay, Kasperic, Larson, Lockhart, Summers, and Walters. One excuse, Representative Byrd, signed by Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Further reviewed by your committee number 2, who respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhardt, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that bill number 193 do pass. And I'd like you to start your clocks because it's promised to be done in 30 seconds. And I'll turn the explanation over the bill to the good legislator from our capital city county.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is to fund an extra $50 for the memorial services at funerals for veterans. We've been paying this $50 an added $50 for the last few years appropriations, so we've already been paying for it. This just codifies the bill and makes it happen. There's a standing committee amendment, so I would ask for the movement of the standing committee amendment through the vice chair of the appropriations.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 193 and ask you for your favorable consideration. Basically, what this amendment does, Mr. Chairman, is delete the July 1 and insert immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for a bill to become law, as provided by Article 4, Section 8 of the Wyoming Constitution.
Question on Standing Committee.
Question having been called on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would move that when the committee arrives and report that you would approve the House Bill Number 193 as explained.
Question being called. All those in favor, Representative Patton's Lockhart's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that the bill number 193 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. House bill number 193 has passed the committee of the whole. Our next bill that we will be looking at will be House Joint Number 10. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Joint Resolution Number 10 from Representative Halverson, a joint resolution to memorialize the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta and to highlight its enduring principles of liberty embodied therein. Mr. Chairman, your committee number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Joint 10, Magna Carta, respectfully reports sent back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Hunt, Yeagy, Larson, Lindholm, and McKim, signed by Representative McKim, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McKim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution Number 10 do pass. And I turn the explanation of the bill over to the representative from the Valley of the Stars.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you stop 100 people on the street and ask them, what's Magna Carta, there's a likelihood that maybe one person will know the answer. And the answer is, Magna Carta is one of the ancient documents to which our founding fathers turned in crafting their vision for this country, the greatest experiment in self-government in the history of the world. Magna Carta is Latin for Great Charter. It's also called Magna Carta Libertatum, which means the Great Charter of Liberties. It was issued by King John of England at Runnymede on June 15, 1215, Anno Domini. In 1215, England was ruled by King John. John and his predecessors had ruled using the principle of vis et voluntas, or force and will, taking executive and sometimes arbitrary decisions, often justified on the basis that the king was above the law. The Great Charter was drafted by the Archbishop of Canterbury to make peace between the unpopular king and a group of rebel Anglo-Saxon barons. It promised the protection of the church, first and foremost, protection of the church rights, protection for the Anglo-Saxons from illegal imprisonment, protection for the Anglo-Saxons to access to swift justice, and limitations on feudal payments to the crown. For its enforcement, the Great Charter established a council of 25 barons, the distant ancestor of the British Parliament, and therefore the basis, 800 years later, of this Wyoming legislature. Magna Carta is an important symbol of liberty today, often cited by politicians and campaigners, and is held in great respect by British and American legal communities. The highly regarded barrister Lord Denning describes it as the greatest constitutional document of all times, the foundation of the freedom of the individual against the arbitrary authority of the despot. The document is honored in the United States as an antecedent of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land regarding the manner in which Magna Carta had come to be regarded as fundamental law. Many comparisons are possible. For example, our Fifth Amendment guarantees that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That is straight from the Magna Carta. In addition, the Magna Carta gave women, wives and daughters, the right of inheritance. This was unheard of in medieval England. The Ninth Amendment to the United States Constitution states that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. This is also directly from the Magna Carta. There are only four surviving editions of the Magna Carta. One of them was sent in 1976 to Philadelphia when, as this country celebrated its bicentennial. Unfortunately, we won't be seeing one. They will be all over the British Isles in this 800th year. In these times, in this country, in this state of Wyoming, I ask your support in commemorating this document, Magna Carta, and the brave Anglo-Saxons who recognized and demanded of a king our God-given, inalienable, self-evident rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The resolution before you resolves in sections 1 and 2 that the state of Wyoming acknowledge and celebrate in some unprescribed manner the date June 15th, 2015 as the 800th anniversary of the signing of the Magna Carta and to encourage the teaching and informing of the history and significance of this document throughout the state. Finally, in Section 3, the resolution resolves that the great state of Wyoming defend the ideals of Runnymede with the same steadfast determination as those ancient Anglo-Saxons 800 years ago. And may the Magna Carta see its millennial anniversary similarly celebrated. I ask for your aye vote.
Question being called, all those in favor of Representative McKim's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number House Joint Resolution 10 do pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
House Joint Resolution 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration will be House Joint Resolution number 9. If the reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Joint Resolution 9 from Representative Miller, a joint resolution requesting Congress to propose an amendment to the United States Constitution, repealing the 17th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Mr. Chairman, the Committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Joint Resolution 9, repeal 17th Amendment dash 2, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Halverson, Croker, Miller, Winters. Those who voted no, Representative Escobar, Crone, Pelkey, and Pinal, and as signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendations that House Joint Resolution number 9 do pass. And, folks, this is a pretty simple little bill. It's a resolution that asks Congress to bring legislation repealing the 17th Amendment to the United States Constitution. As you all know, the 17th Amendment was ratified in 1913. It changed the vote, it changed the selection of our senators from basically the legislature to the way we select our federal senators, just a simple election. And that goes against what the intent of our founding fathers was. And, you know, think about 1913. You know, we have an artifact upstairs right here that some awful interesting things were going on in 1913. The only picture of this body that doesn't include both parties happens in 1913, and one of them has a hole in it. You know, you've probably heard the story, and so I'll let you, if you haven't heard the story, I'll let you discover that on your own. You know, what else happened in 1913? Well, it's right pre-World War I. Lots of interesting things were happening. Our national tax on our income was put into place at that time. Also, private agency that has the name federal in it was created at that time that most people think is a government agency, of which it is not. So there were lots of interesting things going on. So maybe our founding fathers had a good idea, and we ought to go back to that. So what the bill does is just ask for the resolution. Whereas the founders of the Republic and the framers of the Constitution recognized that in a Republican government, the legislative authority being necessarily predominant, that it should be divided into two different branches composed by different modes of election, creating different principles of action and as little connection with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependencies on society would admit. So what they did is, you know, this body, along with the Senate, selected our senators that went to Washington. What the 17th Amendment did is it turned it into a popular vote, just like our members of Congress. So now they're both elected by popular vote. So, you know, are we wiser than the elected or the people that would be voting on this, or the people that vote on it now? Not necessarily. I think we do understand the process a lot better. And we've been down the road and fought many battles. That's where the advantage is in selecting our senators. No, we're not smarter than the voters back home. You know, a number of our founding fathers, James Madison, the appointment of senators by state legislature gives the state government such an agency in the formation of the federal government as must secure the authority of the former. Alexander Hamilton, legislatures were selected bodies of men. The choice of United States senators would generally be made with peculiar care and judgment by the legislatures. You know, it's just not who's most popular in the vote. You know, it's just the way our founding fathers intended it. The founders of the Constitution created an ingenious template of checks and balances with divisions and distributions of power to provide for and protect the highest sovereignty, that of each individual citizen. And so I ask you to consider joining me in supporting this resolution. You know, it's not going to have a huge impact. I don't know if our president will read it. I know our own members of Congress will read it. But there's a lot of others back there. But frankly, there's a little bit more interesting Congress right now. So maybe this might gain some more weight if we provide a little bit of encouragement. So on and for the bill, and I ask for your support.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just couldn't resist saying that I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps the founders set it up the way they did because we hadn't yet gotten around to passing the 19th Amendment.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little history lesson. When the Constitution was set up, the balance was between the federal government and the states, not the federal government and the people. The people elect the representatives under the original Constitution, and these bodies that we're in handled the Senate, and that gave states control over the Senate. Frankly, I think if we had the same situation now, we wouldn't have so many of the problems we do have. We wouldn't have people wanting to have Article 5 conventions, demanding balanced budgets and that sort of thing. The states would have control over at least one body. And it was the idea that the federal government and the states had to work together. It was a united states. It wasn't a confederation. And if you look back at the famous papers written, that was the concept. It was a balancing act between everyone concerned, with the states having a lot more stake in it than they do now. And that. So I would ask you to support the resolution. Whether we get it, I don't know whether you could get the 17th Amendment repealed or not, but I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. One thing you'll hear is that the senators used to buy their seats. There's corruption in everything. And interesting note in history, after the 17th Amendment was passed, everybody said, yeah, that'll fix what they perceived to be corruption. I think my recollection is all but one senator was reelected popularly and sent to Washington. There was one who I believe was tried and convicted of some sort of impropriety. But they were all reelected, so it didn't really have the effect of throw the bums out and get rid of the corruption that people thought it would.
Speaker Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little bit of history. This has come up before in this body, and so I took the trouble to do some real research on the 17th Amendment. And I started by talking to the library, librarian at the university, and I said, would you do me a favor and go dig up the newspapers around the time when this amendment was passed, because I want to read them and see what they were saying. I was able to shortcut that because one of our historians at the university was standing there, and he said, I'll give you three examples. So here they are. Number one, the copper barons in the state north to us. One of those copper barons, after he'd made a lot of money there, went down to the state where the Sin City is and got control of a copper mine in that state. The stock was worth pennies, and I think when he finally sold out, he sold that stock for $51 a share. Became one of the wealthiest people in the United States. The county where the Sin City is named after him. If you know the name of that county, you know his name. And he
incidentally, his daughter then was, what, it was quite an interesting story that's been running in the news. She lived in a hospital for 15 years, finally died, and one of his grandsons died in one of our southwest counties. Penniless at the time he died, although she was reported to have about $500 million when she died. And that's $500 million after a long passage of time. So after all that success, he went home to a state north of us and ran an election and got himself elected as a U.S. Senator. And the election was so crooked, one of our humorists one time wrote what to me is one of the most castigating articles about anybody that I've ever read. And you ought to read it and just see what he said about the guy. To which the copper baron responded and said, "I never paid a man that didn't want to be bought." After he won that election, he went to Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Senate refused to seat him because the election was so bad. He went back home and ran a semi-legitimate election and got himself elected, went to the U.S. Senate, and didn't do much in particular. So there's one example of what was wrong with the system. He actually bribed his way into that seat. The second example that was given to me is the same state that holds the Sin City for many years was destitute, as were many states. And so the state to the west of it, on the west coast, I call the state of fruits and nuts, they used to offer money in the state that holds the Sin City, and they'd send a couple of ringers over there who would establish residency. Money would be paid, which that state desperately needed to run their finances, and those two ringers would be elected as senators from that state, which gave the state for many years, the state of fruits and nuts was reputed to have four senators by virtue of that ruse. So that's number two. Number three, about the time that was mentioned when those two pictures were taken that are up there, and those two pictures were taken because there was such a deep divide in this body, they refused to have their pictures taken together. Our legislature deadlocked on who to send as a U.S. Senator, and for a period of time, we only had one U.S. Senator because we were deadlocked and couldn't send a second one there. Now, there are three reasons, and those were not the only corruption cases. There were a lot of corruption cases. Now, you say, well, today's different. Well, maybe it is, but there are some people. There's the computer guy. There's the Oracle of Omaha. There are some different people around. We all know who they are. They have a lot of money. They could easily afford to come in here and offer each of us $1 million net. They pay the tax. They gross it up, offer us $1 million net. Do you think we'd crack? What about $2 million? What about $5 million? Could this legislature be bought? Don't kid yourself. It could become very tempting. And so that was the reason, primarily the corruption was the reason that the 17th Amendment passed. And it passed to take the control of who those people were out of legislative bodies that were capable of corruption and vest it with the people. Now, I'm not saying there isn't corruption in those elections, but not like there was in those elections. So for all those reasons, and primarily the corruption thing, I'm against repealing the 17th Amendment, and I would ask you to vote against this. And if you vote for it, remember, those things can happen again. I understand it's difficult. I saw a number here a while back, I think it's accurate, the average U.S. senator represents 843,000 people. And given some of the political dialogue that we've had, you know, 843,000 people is about almost 300,000 more than live in this state. And I don't know if 843,000 people could agree on whether the sun came up or not. And so that's the problem. I understand the problem, but this is not the solution. And I understand it'd be nice for this legislature to say, to send a note to our U.S. senators and say, come home, E.T., we want to visit with you. And that sounds like a very nice thing. But on balance, when you look at history and why this amendment was passed in the first place, I just think it's a bad idea, on and against the resolution.
Excuse
Excuse me.
Just a second there.
Representative Miller.
And we lived happily ever after 1913.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill, House Joint Resolution number 9 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
All those in favor, would you please stand? House Joint Resolution opposite, okay. All those opposed, please stand. House Joint Resolution 9 has failed the Committee of the Whole. Roll call. Roll call. Having failed a standing vote, the clerk will please call the roll.
Allen.
No.
Baker.
No.
Baldwin.
No.
Barlow.
No.
Berger.
No.
Blackburn.
No.
Blake.
No.
Burkhart.
Aye.
Bird.
No.
Campbell.
No.
Kennedy.
No.
Clem.
Aye.
Connolly.
No.
Dayton.
No.
Edmonds.
Aye.
Edwards.
Aye.
Eklund.
Esquivel.
No. Freeman.
No.
Gay.
Aye.
Greer.
Aye.
Halverson.
Aye.
Harshman excused. Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
Aye.
Yagi.
Aye.
Jennings.
Aye.
Kasparic excused. Kirkbride. Kirkbride.
No.
Croker.
Aye.
Crone.
No.
Larson Lloyd.
No.
Larson Dan.
Aye.
Lindholm.
No.
Lockhart. Laux.
Aye.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz.
No.
Nicholas.
No.
Northrup.
No.
Patton.
No.
Patton.
No.
Paxton.
No.
Pelkey.
No.
Petroff.
No.
Piperinen.
Aye.
Pinnell.
No.
Reeder.
Aye.
Schwartz.
No.
Summers.
No.
Steinmetz.
Aye.
Stubson.
No.
Throne.
No.
Walters.
No.
Wilson. Winters.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dan.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 20 aye, 38 no, 2 excused.
It's failed, the Committee of the Whole. House Joint Resolution 9 has failed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Up to your left in the North Gallery is a constituent of mine who, through fate and so forth and blah, 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 has also become a member of my family through marriage. My cousin married her daughter, and she is also a member of our state school board, so please welcome from Lusk, Wyoming, Miss Kathy Kuhn.
welcome to the House. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 14. If the reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 14 from the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to the Wyoming Controlled Substance Act, amending and expanding procedures and requirements for forfeiting and seizing property, providing definitions, conforming provisions, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman of Committee No. 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred Senate File 14, Asset Forfeiture-2, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Pardon me? Yeah, I know. You're excused, Mr. Croker. Thank you. No, you're right. All right, here we go. We'll try it again. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 14, engrossed, Asset Forfeiture-2, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Croker, Miller, Pelkey, and Winters. Two noes, Representatives Crone and Pinnell, and signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number Senate File 14 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. The amendment is real simple, and the floor manager of the bill will explain it when he talks about the bill. So I'd ask for your approval now. So please vote aye on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back to the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're bringing this Senate file now because the following bill is very similar. The penalties are essentially a mirror of this bill, so that's why we've brought it a little bit earlier than we normally would. So with that, Representative Croker will explain the bill.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I present to you Senate File 14, Asset Forfeiture 2, and this bill to me was really a lesson in why we have our committee process and why our committee process works so well. Many of you may remember this topic. I brought a bill last session that dealt with the reform of this measure that this body chose to pass on. It did not make it past the other chamber, but it was picked up as a interim topic, and we spent significant amount of time this interim working on two different bills. We decided to only proceed with one, and the bill that we came up with is so much better than the one that we passed out last year. I think it is really a demonstration of why we have our committee process and why I think our faith is so strong in the process and demonstrating why it works so well. The first thing that we learned when we were studying, I also want to mention there are two handouts that were passed out recently in your box that kind of deal with this if you want to take a look at those. They just provide a little bit more information. The first thing that we found that was really encouraging to me is this process gave us a chance to realize how good our law enforcement is here in Wyoming. And in some other parts of the country, there have been some horrible abuses of similar laws. If you want an example, go to an internet search engine and type in the name of the city of brotherly love, that city's name along with civil asset forfeiture, and you'll see some horror stories, and you'll also find a video that's partly hilarious and partly scary when you realize what the subject matter is. But we didn't see that in Wyoming. We saw no cases of abuse, and I really want to commend our law enforcement agencies for how well they have handled this topic. And I want to make it clear that there is a difference between the abuse of law and an abusive law. And that's what we've got here in Wyoming. We've got an abusive law. We've got a bad law. And fortunately, it has not been abused by law enforcement. But it's important for us as a body to make sure that we have good laws and good legislation and make sure that we get those right. Let me explain a little bit about what civil asset forfeiture is. Civil asset forfeiture is where you find somebody, you suspect them of a crime, and you seize their possessions. And the process of civil asset forfeiture does not require that individual to be charged with a crime. We think, and I think rightly so, that our justice system is based on the premise of a person is innocent until proven guilty. Unfortunately, under the process of civil asset forfeiture, they are guilty until proven innocent. It is up to the individual to initiate legal action to sue the state to get his possessions back, and the standard of proof is such that he is required to prove his innocence, because it is a much lower standard that the state has to prove, as opposed to a criminal trial where the person on trial is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and it is up to the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt his guilt. Oftentimes what happens, and one of the things that we found, one of the groups that presented information to us studied every civil asset forfeiture proceedings of the past, I believe it was 6 years, and they found that the vast majority of the cases, they estimated it was about 95% of the cases, the individual was tried and convicted of a felony. And so what we want to do with this bill is basically take two different processes and merge them into one. When someone is charged with a crime, they're innocent until proven guilty. They are provided an attorney if they can't afford one, and it's up to the state to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Oftentimes, a person who has undergone the process of civil asset forfeiture has two proceedings against them at once. One is a criminal case where they're provided with an attorney and presumed innocent. The other is a civil case that's tried in a different court, oftentimes a different jurisdiction, and where they are not provided with an attorney unless they can afford one, and where they are not presumed innocent. And what this process does is it takes those two different proceedings that are going on and merges them into one, where the person is presumed innocent, they are given their criminal trial. After they are convicted and found guilty as part of the sentencing, the judge then can order the property forfeited to the state. And so I believe that the process is much better. It's restored. It respects, I think, the rights that we all hold dear. One thing that I want to make clear is that where the money goes doesn't change. We had a different bill that we debated that this body chose to not pass on that would have changed where the flow of the money goes from these assets that are seized. And this bill does not do any of that at all. This bill does not change where the money goes. It only changes the process. And one of the problems that we found is the median amount that was seized was around $2,000. Well, especially if you're from out of state, if you have $2,000 seized from you, by the time you hire an attorney, go to court, and prove your innocence, you've spent more than $2,000 to go through that process and get it back, so it isn't even worth challenging. I think it's very important, again, to uphold the standard of justice that before the government can forfeit your property, that you are found guilty of a crime. Another thing that I want to make clear is I want to clarify the difference between seizure and forfeiture, because this bill does not change the process of the seizure. It only changed the process of the forfeiture. So, for example, let's say that the highway patrol were to pull somebody over and he were to have a large quantity of drugs and a large quantity of cash in his possession. they would be able to seize that cash and those drugs right there the same way that you would seize any other evidence for a crime. Also in this crime, to dispose of any illegal substances such as drugs, there is no conviction necessary. If you find drugs, law enforcement can take those and destroy those immediately. There's no, because the substance itself is illegal, you don't have to prove or establish guilt of a crime there. But so the process of the seizure wouldn't change. The difference is those assets would be held by the state. The individual would be given his criminal trial. After he's found guilty, then the judge would conduct the forfeiture hearing. And if he determined that those assets were part of the crime and due to be forfeited, then he would have the forfeiture order, and that's when that property would become those possessions would become the property of the state. So it doesn't affect the ability to seize the assets. It only directs a process for how the court case is handled and the final order of forfeiture is given down. One other thing that the bill does is it also has a provision to clarify an innocent third-party owner. For example, if somebody was running drugs and their car was seized and the bank had a loan on the car, the bank would be able to come in and show that they had a lien on the car and they would be an innocent third party. They would not lose their interest in the car. That innocent third party is protected. I won't go through page by page by the bill because that's what the bill does is creates that process that I've described. If you have any specific questions, I would be happy to answer them. And as far as the amendment that we passed goes, it was just a cleanup amendment that just changed a couple words into what's consistent in other parts of statute. There was no substantive change in the law. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill, and I think that the representative from the center of the state did an excellent job describing the bill. Very thorough, very good explanation. Problem I have with this bill is that you're taking the highest standard that we have in the law, beyond reasonable doubt, and you're placing it basically as a pretext into a civil case. So if you look at the existing law, and I think it's also something that the speaker noted that it's important to note for the whole body, there has not been an abuse of the existing system. There has not been an abuse here in the state of Wyoming. This has been asset forfeiture has been on the books for roughly 40 years, and we haven't had a pattern of abuse in the state. So, number one, you have to question whether or not we really want to go this far. The current standard is a standard of preponderance of the evidence, and that is a lower standard. And there was some discussion about raising that to the middle standard, which is clear and convincing evidence. The problem that I have with this is that we're raising it to the highest standard, the highest burden of proof, beyond a reasonable doubt, before we can move into the section of the civil case. And then that is then it reverts back to a preponderance standard. So you have a system that's working. You have a system that's not being abused. You have a system that provides quite a bit of funding to local law enforcement agencies and state agencies to combat crime. And you're taking it and you're because you're afraid of something that might happen in the future, you're putting it onto the same standard as you would a criminal conviction. So I think this goes too far. I plan on, if this does come out of committee of the whole, I plan on presenting a third or second or third reading amendment. And if we really wanted to make it a better standard, why not do something in between, a clear and convincing standard, rather than having that conviction prior to the forfeiture? So I would urge the body to resist this bill. Thank you.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would push back on that a little because I would say that it should be guilt beyond a reasonable doubt before the government can come and take somebody's possessions away. That's what we're talking about here. The difference with most civil cases is it's between two people or a person and a corporation where the government is basically serving as the judge to settle a dispute, and so you don't need that clear and convincing evidence. They have to make a court which side is right, this one or this one. With civil asset forfeiture, we're talking about the government coming and taking away property from a private citizen. In order to do that, they should have the standard beyond a reasonable doubt. It shouldn't be just a preponderance of the evidence. So I think that that's very clear, and that's what this bill does, and I think that's a protection that's very necessary.
Representative Conley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to share with the body an example that was given to us in joint judiciary and that gets repeated by law enforcement when they testify in the Judiciary Committee. And I think it's a good example because you could really consider what side you're on. Right now, law enforcement in Wyoming is allowed to, and this is the example that's given, and I think I'm actually mixing a couple of them together, but a motorist driving across I-80, for example, and I don't know why drug mules speed, but they do speed, all right, and they get pulled over. And they give the example of someone being pulled over with, and they get asked, can we search your car? The answer is yes, and what's found is shrink-wrapped money. All right, shrink-wrapped money that a drug dog sniffs and finds some kind of residue on shrink-wrapped money. All right, to our law enforcement, this smells like a drug mule, but they find nothing else. They find nothing else at all. So they say to the drug mule, or they say to the individual who they assume to be a drug mule, you know, we think you're a drug mule. And either you hightail it out of town, or we're going to find something to convict you on, or we're going to keep your money. And so what does the person do? The person hightails it out of town, and we have now seized and forfeited that money. Okay? If you think that's a good thing, all right, then you currently like the laws that are on our books. If, however, you think that we as a state should have a higher reason, a higher level for taking, seizing, and having an individual forfeit one of their assets, being money, then what this bill does is demand that there is a conviction before the state can attempt to seize and have property forfeited. And so if you're in favor instead of that higher level for the state, right, to behave in terms of taking an individual's property, then vote for this bill.
Representative Pennell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure on this particular case that was talked about, maybe we need to add a little more to it, that there was, if it's the one that there was approximately $17,000 seized, it went through a process, a due process, and it come out to be that they probably needed to give the money back, and so they did, I think the problem of the issue was going to take quite a while. Well, this individual had a lengthy criminal history, and at the time that they were going to try to get the money back, he was already indicted on federal drug charges in another state. They finally eventually did get the money back to a member of the family, and I'm not sure if there was a weapon involved. Where he was convicted of the felony, he didn't get the weapon back. It was offered to the family. They refused to take it. I'm not sure if that was the same story or not, but in a lot of these stories, there was always some drugs involved. And what in this particular bill, what bothers me is we've talked about the mule and so forth during the transport. They may have a small amount of narcotics on them that would bring it to a misdemeanor offense. And under this bill, they wouldn't be charged with the felony. They might be carrying a load of cash, $300,000-$400,000. That money will go right on back to the cartel or the drug dealers, wherever it was destined to go. So there is some concerns about this. And as it's been stated, there's not an issue that we've had here in Wyoming. Remember, this is Wyoming. They say we compare us to other states and things like that. They've got bills like this we're not compared to other states the way I look at it. We're Wyoming. We're individually a state that people love to come to because we do have good laws here. And this is one that I think we don't need to change. Thank you.
Speaker Brown.
Here's another example. Vote your conscience. Here's another example that was given to me by law enforcement. A guy with a car hauler hauling cars across the United States gets stopped for some traffic offense. Officer has some sort of probable cause. They bring in the dog. The dog gets up on the car hauler, and one of the car haulers, the dog finds drugs and money. They go to the truck driver. The truck driver says, I don't know anything about it. I picked these cars up way back when. The guy paid me cash, gave me directions to haul the car, and I left with the car. So now we have the drugs. We have the money. We've got a truck driver that's not culpable for what went on, and nobody's ever going to be convicted of a felony. So I guess those funds are never forfeited. So I don't know where they go. But if this bill passes, law enforcement can't have that money.
Representative Coker.
I'll just close by again reminding the body that in America we're innocent until proven guilty, and I think it's important to have laws that reflect that, and I think it's important to not depend on good intentions continuing to have good enforcement of what is a bad law. I think we owe it to our people to fix the law, to make it right, and to offer that protection. And again, before the government should be able to seize a large amount of cash from a private citizen, they should have to be able to prove a crime against them. So I would ask you to support this bill, and if there's no further questions, I'll call for the question.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond to that one example where it's not my money, basically I think that would probably flow into our unclaimed property statutes. So someone would get that money in the state at some point. I don't know if that goes into the general fund or where it goes. But also, I'm on and for the bill. I think they should be convicted before they can seize their assets. That's just a simple premise I think we should operate under.
Is there any other discussion? Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number Senate file 14 do pass. All those in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Senate file 14 has passed. The Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for discussion is House Bill 186. If the reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 186 from Representative Connolly, an act relating to human trafficking, providing for forfeiture and seizure of specified property, specifying the procedures for forfeiture and seizure of property, providing exceptions, specifying distribution of proceeds from forfeited property, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, the Committee Number 1 Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 186, Human Trafficking, Forfeiture of Property, respectfully report saying back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 186 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments, which are extensive, and I'll let the Representative Connolly explain the bill and the amendment.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman. Friends, I bring to you human trafficking forfeiture of property. And if you'll indulge me for a little minute, I'd like to just talk a little bit about what happened 2 years ago in this body when we passed the anti-human trafficking bill. We were the last state in the nation to address this topic. And even though I would have hoped that there was no need for us to pass an anti-human trafficking bill, one of the things in the course of adding forfeiture of property to this statute showed us is that that bill 2 years ago was needed. Our Division of Victim Services came and testified that they, in fact, have taken care of 8 victims of human trafficking in the first year and 4 victims in this current year. And so, on one hand, I'm sorry to report that. On the other hand, I am so happy that we as a body passed this bill 2 years ago. Okay. So when we were talking about this bill extensively 2 years ago, we had incorporated an asset forfeiture section into it. We picked up our asset forfeiture from drug trafficking and we put it into the human trafficking bill. And while we were in the midst of that debate, we really as a body decided, you know what, we need to take a better and more thorough look at asset forfeiture. That resulted in the bill that the good representative in the previous bill talked about, that we decided last year, you know what, we're not done yet, and we put it to an interim study. I can't tell you how much this body has looked at asset forfeiture in the last 2 years and ended up with the bill that we just passed, where we have moved from a civil asset forfeiture system to a criminal asset forfeiture system upon conviction. What I'd like to suggest is even if you preferred the civil asset forfeiture method, I think that you'll like what we're doing here in this bill. Because right now, there is no asset forfeiture upon a felony conviction for human trafficking. There just is none at all. And what this bill does is now allow for asset forfeiture upon a felony conviction of human trafficking. Now, the reason why there is such a long-standing committee amendment and why we did the Senate file first is that what you're looking at in front of you with the human trafficking bill is exactly what we did during the joint interim committee on asset forfeiture. The engrossed Senate file bill that you have in front of you is what the Senate did with what you're looking at here with human trafficking. And what the long amendment does is incorporate into this bill exactly what you voted on in favor of in Senate File 14 that we just passed, as well as a couple of very minor tweaks that the Division of Victim Services suggested as it relates specifically to human trafficking. So again, this human trafficking asset forfeiture bill that you have in front of you is exactly what we just passed for Senate File 14 for asset forfeiture for drug trafficking. So I hope that's enough explanation without walking you through the bill because, again, it's exactly what we just did.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, I think any time the last speaker and I can agree, it's got to be a great idea. But I really appreciate her bringing this bill because I think fixed what was a flaw in the bill that we had last year. That was a very good bill. We took this out to make sure we got it right, and I think we did. We made sure that the person is convicted of the crime before their assets can be taken, and their assets have to have been used in human trafficking to be subject to the forfeiture. I think that's a good process. And keep in mind the policy decision that we as a body here are considering before ourselves is this an appropriate penalty to add on to human trafficking? So if somebody's convicted of a crime right now, they can spend time in jail. Is it also appropriate to be able to take the fruits of the fruits of their illegal activity from them? And I think it is. So I would encourage you to vote for the bill.
Question have been called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Bill Number 1, please vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Standing Committee Bill Number 1 has been adopted. Back to the bill. Questioning have been called. All those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 186 do pass. All those in favor of the bill, please vote aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 186 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 211. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 211 from Representative Pelkey, an act relating to criminal procedure allowing a motion for new trial for persons convicted of a felony upon a showing of actual innocence based on non-DNA evidence, specifying requirements and conditions, specifying retention of governmental immunity, conforming related provisions, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 211, Post-Conviction Actual Innocence, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted for aye, Representatives Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, and Winters, one no vote, Representative Pinnell, and is signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 211 do pass. And Representative Pelkey will explain the bill.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is a bill that made an appearance here last year and made it through both houses and then died in conference. There were some questions about compensation for those who had been cleared, and that's what ultimately killed this bill. This is virtually identical to the version that passed last year. In essence, it just provides a final opportunity for somebody who's come across new evidence in the criminal case to ask for a new trial, and that petition can be reviewed by the court, and once it's accepted or rejected, that's a non-appealable decision. I'll walk you through the bill. This, you may recognize that we already have in statute a similar bill for someone who could be cleared based on DNA evidence. This simply expands that to include non-DNA evidence, non-DNA exculpatory evidence. What it would require is a motion for a trial based on actual innocence. If the person was convicted for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence that the person is actually innocent of the crime or crimes of which the person was convicted, that motion has to identify with specificity newly discovered material evidence other than DNA. If it were DNA, they could invoke the existing statute, which if proven would establish by clear and convincing evidence that the movement is actually innocent. So what we're doing is we're setting a slightly lower standard, clear and convincing evidence, but once that trial has been granted, that new trial, the burden shifts to the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is in fact guilty. It's essential here to point out that this bill, this were it to become statute, would be if other opportunities for relief were exhausted. There are certain time limits under case law and statute that would prevent somebody from asking for a new trial, even if there was clear and convincing evidence of their innocence. If it came after 5 years, or if that evidence appeared in the absence of another constitutional violation in that matter, there really isn't any opportunity for someone to ask for a new trial. This merely affords them that opportunity. Since we've been using DNA for purposes in criminal trials, there have been about 325 innocent people who've been freed from prison in the United States as a result of DNA testing. But DNA is available only in a small number of those cases. Vast majority of innocent prisoners do not have the benefit of DNA evidence to assist their exoneration and need other statutory avenues by which to prove their innocence with non-biological evidence. Although more than 1,200 innocent people have been freed from prison in the United States where no DNA is available to prove their innocence, very few of these innocent people have had the benefit of a declaration of innocence or access to compensation. This this case, I do want to mention as this year's or this version of the bill has makes no addresses the issue of does not address the issue of compensation, so that's not an issue. Last year, this legislation had a had the support of both defense attorneys and a number of highly regarded prosecutors, and the past attorney general. Currently, 29 states. the individuals covered by this legislation are completely innocent of the crimes that they were convicted of, and as I mentioned earlier, have no other opportunity to show that in a court of law and to get their records exonerated and to be freed. Excuse me, and to be freed from prison. I stand open for questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 211 do pass. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. House Bill 211 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Majority 4, Leader Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, the Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 149, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 152, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 255, amended. Recommended do pass, sorry. House Bill 183, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 47, recommended do pass. House Bill 228, recommended do pass. House Bill 214, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 138, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Berger moved that the House rise and sit again. House Bill 118, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 107, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 209, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 143, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 192, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 193, amended, recommended do pass. House Joint Resolution 10, recommended do pass. House Joint Resolution number 9, followed on a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Senate File 14, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 186, amended. Why are they? Recommended do pass. House Bill 211, recommended do pass, signed by Representative Edwards, Chairman.
Representative Edwards.
Mr. Speaker,
I move the adoption of the committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Congratulations, Representative Edwards. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 182. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 62, Oral Chemotherapy Parity, Ayes 28, 2 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 183. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 111, Summary Probate Proceedings, Ayes 28, 2 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 184, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 126, Water Quality, Ayes 27, 1 no, 2 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 185, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 132, Wyoming Fair Housing Act, Ayes 28, no 0, 2 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Madam Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Please, proceed.
Mr. Speaker, I am going to try and have my aide up in the minority office upon adjournment to distribute mugs. So, coffee mugs. So, if anybody wants to come pick up their mugs, please do so. Thank you.
That would be a mugging. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 210, Guardian Ad Litem Division, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Escobel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Pelkey, Pinnell, Winters, 2 no votes, Representatives Baker and Miller, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 219, Decorated Combat Veterans License Plates, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Kennedy, Eklund. Those who voted no, Representative Laux, Reeder, Walters, and Dave Zwanitzer, signed by Representative Blake, Vice Chairman.
Re-referrals. Chairman Swanser, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to re-refer House Bill 219 to your Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
House Bill 219 is re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Any other re-referrals? Committee report, or committee announcements. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Friday morning at 8 a.m. in room H18 to consider four bills, House Bill 176, House Bill 236, House Bill 224, and House Bill 229.
Governor Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 5th at 7:30 a.m. in room H8 to continue House Bill 158, which is carried over from today, to hear House Bill 195, which was originally scheduled for today, but we didn't get to it, and House Bill 243. Furthermore, we'll meet at noon on Thursday to consider House Bill 222 and House Bill 230.
Chairman Zwanitzer, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow night, 10 minutes after adjournment, in H-17 to hear two bills, House Bill 241, Electronic Driver's License, and House Bill 223, YDOT General Fund Budget Request.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet at 5 p.m. in 10 minutes in room H17 to hear House Bill 216, Veteran Skilled Nursing Center, House Bill 240, Physician Assistant School, and if time permits, House Bill 246, Acupuncture Practice Act.
Vice Chairman Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number two, Appropriations, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to hear House Bill 174, Nicotine Products Regulation, House Bill 187, Marijuana Impact Study, and then we will meet again at noon. Let me find. Trying to find what we're doing at noon here. For now, I believe that's it, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman McKim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number five, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. to hear the following bills: House Bill 203, Livestock Brands Reciprocity; House Bill 165, Access to Public Lands. And just a reminder, around 8 o'clock, we will have the students from the FFA Frontier Chapter of East High School preparing for the state championship. We'll be speaking on agricultural issues. They will debate the Western Watershed Trespass Litigation. Everyone's invited.
Vice Chairman Northrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number four, Education, will meet upon adjournment in room 10 to consider the following bills: House Bill 11, House Bill 204. Thank you.
Chairman Swanser Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions number seven, will meet tomorrow morning at 8:15 to hear House Bill 227, Cannabidiol Medications; House Bill 235, Foreign Business Entities; and House Bill 232, Open Meetings. We will continue upon noon recess in room 302 to hear House Bill 171, Architect In-State Residency Definitions.
Vice Chairman Moniz, for your second time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We will, your committee number two, House Appropriations, will also meet at noon tomorrow to hear House Bill 163, Critical Access Hospital Endowment Challenge Program.
Representative Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Yes, please proceed.
Once again, the weekly prayer breakfast tomorrow morning, 6:30 at the Egg with Dr. Richard Berry. We hope you can join us. Thank you.
Adam, Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for all of your hard work today. The good news first is that you got through a lot of bills, so that's really good. So with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, February 5th, 2015. And with that, I'd like to give you your general file list. It is House Bill 233, 197, 212, 237, 210, 201, 28, and 142. I'll repeat it one more time. 233, 197, 212, 237, 210, 201, 28, and 142.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Representative Blake.